ครับ
Much. And there's no need for an action tonight. We can explore this further, or whatever we can have whatever discussion we want. It's just trying to open the discussion and see where we go from there. So on the phone we have Wayne Lumsden and Wayne Young, and I believe Mr. Lumsden, you're going to start the presentation.
Yes, sir. We'd like to have slide one.
It's up now.
Okay. Before I get into that. Wayne Young will be Mr. Young, since we have two Waynes, and he's going to do the technical presentation. And Wayne Lumsden, I'm sort of the guy that focused on the bank presentation of actually fishing for these for 30 years. So that's where we're going to start. And the reason, you know, that we got slide one up there is when I was fishing in the Hickory Shad season 2018, I noticed that there were hordes of people catching the shad, and someone were using casting nets, and then they put them in coolers, unlimited, and hauling them off to the car, and then coming back again. And I just want to point out, if you're not familiar with this area, we're talking about 50 to 60 people fishing the spawning area, and Fredericksburg area has a fishing wharf and two fishing piers. We can have anywhere between 50 to 60 people running around there. And the shad season runs from like late March to early May. So a huge number of hickory shad are coming out of the river. This is the Rappahannock I'm speaking of at the moment. And also there's a similar problem on the Potomac tributary called the Occoquan River. So that's why we got started slide one. Now what we'd like to do is have Mr. Young do a technical presentation that he's developed for me for slides 2 to 4. Are we doing okay?
Yep.
Okay, this is Wayne Young, and on slide 2, hickory stock status, if you can call that up, please.
Okay.
As summarized in the slide, and we're only going to do a summary in the interest of time, as you all indicated, there's very limited information available to determine the health of the hickory shad stocks or support informed fisheries management determinations. That would include information or lack of information on the role of the hickory shad as part of the striped bass forage phase, which is a concern to many of us conservationists and fishermen because of an apparent decline in the biomass of the striped bass. The next slide, slide 3, if you would call that up, please.
Okay.
Fishery management status. In the slide is our summary of our understanding of the status. I think the key takeaway here is that hickory shad is combined with American shad for fishery management because of insufficient species-specific data. All other Chesapeake Bay watershed jurisdictions have severely restricted the hickory shad fishery, and in fact have established moratoriums. Slide 4, please. The regional species creel limits. In this tape, it's pretty obvious that everybody has a moratorium except for Virginia, where we have an unrestricted open recreational fishery. The result is that the Virginia run migrates through waters where no take is allowed to waters that are open to unlimited take and are very vulnerable to being taken. And with that quick summary of these slides, which you can consider at your convenience and afterward, I turn it back to Mr. Lumsden.
Okay, thank you, sir. Can we go to slide 5? Are we on slide five?
Yes.
What I'm trying to do here is to give you the topographical and water column that these hickory fans are going into the pond, and it's going to be very shallow, extremely rocky, huge boulders, very narrow channels where they're very vulnerable when they're staging. So let's go to the next slide. This is a topographical map. If you're not very familiar with Fredericksburg area, this is the Fredericksburg-Falmouth area. There's a bridge going across there called Falmouth Bridge. And in that area is where they start to concentrate the stage. You want to go next slide? Okay, here's a good picture I found. You can see the rocky bottom, that bridge, under the bridge, starting past the bridge. You can see the boulders and rocks, very shallow. The fish begin to do their spawning in that direction, okay? Again, you know, it's very, very shallow, boulders, ridges, okay? Next slide. Okay, you can see again the white water, where the water is hitting the rocks and it's running over, very rocky terrain, very shallow. Next slide. Now, this is the one I found and observed. When we have some water, high water come in, this area is covered. You can see the ruggedness. It leaves a big crevice or a hole there, trench, and then water recedes. The shad can be locked up in there, can't get out. The dip netter goes in. These people are kind of crazy. They will get in the swim trunks and just dive right in there and cast net and just haul them out. Next slide, please. This is a detailed slide I took showing how rocky, shallow it is. Okay, you can see the funnel points where if you put a cast net or a dip net there, you can just haul in shad right and left. Next slide, please. This is a similar situation. We're now moving to the Occoquan River, the tributary of the Potomac. This is Occoquan, Virginia, near Dale City, if you're not familiar with it. Next slide, please. Okay, what happens in this situation is the shad go up to the fall line. They hit these gigantic boulders, and above the fall line is a dam. They can wiggle some up into those boulders, but right there at the fall line, the kayakers and cast netters and everything else, when they're running at a peak, they just load up on the shad. So they're stacking up. They have nowhere to go. They may retreat under real cold water conditions, back to deeper water, which is about like 600, 800 feet backwards, but they still have to go up to spawn. It's a great spawning area, but it's very, very vulnerable. Okay, and next slide, please. It's sort of like a summary of my, first introductory term and cool of stuff back. We have a real problem, in this area. So I think now, because of time, I think we're going to refer back to Mr. Young on slide 15.
Slide 15 is our suggestions or recommendations to the commission. We believe that a proactive regulatory approach is needed to ensure the Virginia hickory shad spawning runs are not overfished. We believe there may be sufficient stock to allow a small daily recreational creel limit if there is sufficient area-specific data or an assessment by a credible fishery biologist with knowledge of the local fishery. We believe it would be prudent to establish a data collection and assessment program to inform future fishery management decisions for the species. We also believe that it would be prudent to ban the use of dip nets and cast nets in the spawning reach and staging reach for the hickory shad to allow as good a spawn as possible, and limit the fishery to a rod and reel fishery. We believe that the excessive take could be hurting the spawning run, but in the absence of data as to the health of the species, it's difficult to determine. So for consistency with other jurisdictions, we think that the commission should consider putting some type of creel limit, a reasonable creel limit, on the take of hickory shad in Virginia waters.
Okay, we have a couple more slides. It's Wayne Young. Mr. Young said, what, that's 16 and 17? That's a reference, right? And this is sort of a, you know, sort of like, you know, who we are type graph. And Mr. Young has got quite a credentials and working fishing stuff, orchards and everything, as you can see. And I'm the guy with is down there, you know, on the water with the fishermen, and it just drove me nuts watching them haul them out of there and then come back and haul more. It was so bad that they were using yokes across their back to fill up the coolers so they can carry more coolers quickly. I really encourage BMRC to look at this and, you know, and try to save these fish for our future Hickory Shad fishermen to come. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Does the committee have any questions for Mr. Lumsden and Mr. Young?
Well, nice work, gentlemen. We appreciate you putting this together for us. Yes, Tom?
So these are not covered by a limit in the area where you're talking about? A creel limit?
Are they not covered by a creel limit?
I'm sorry, I could.
Are they not covered by a creel limit in that area?
If there's no creel that BRC has for Hickory Shad, they do have a creel on American Shad, which I was sort of like, huh? So it's unlimited. You know, take all you want, keep coming back for more. It can't sustain that, trust me.
Now, part of our concern, this is Mr. Young again, is that with the moratorium on river herring and on American Shad, that puts additional pressure on the Hickory Shad in Virginia waters because the run is still open and unrestricted.
Okay, one more.
Have you given thought to type of creel limit that would work? How many you'd want?
I don't know if you can hear that. Yes, can you? Did you give any thought to what size creel limit you would recommend?
Mr. Young's got one idea. I'll have another one. I'm a catching and release fisherman. A lot of us fly fishermen and spin fishermen, we were doing that until the horse came with the dip net, and multiple hooks, yanking them out of there. So we had a good thing going until the horse came, and the horse are getting worse. So I guess I encourage, you know, catching and release because that's what they do in the district, and it's a big fishery. It brings in a lot of money, licenses, lures, et cetera. It's a big thing. It's called Fletcher's. Go up towards the Little Falls in D.C. They stack up there, let the people release them. So it's a big market, makes money. People buy licenses, you know. It's a win-win-win situation. For creel, if we had to go that way, option two, you know, I would think 2 to 4. If somebody wants to eat a couple for dinner, you know, I won't have a heart attack. But if he carries on, you know, igloo coolers, you know, with 15 pounds a piece, I get excited about that. Did that help any or confuse you?
No, that was fine.
Okay.
Wayne Young again. I would agree with Wayne Lumsden on either approach. However, I do feel that it would be important for a fishery biologist to provide information to the commission with respect to what might be a reasonable recreational take. I don't know what that is. It may be 2, it may be 4. I think the largest take that I'm aware of that's allowed recreationally on the East Coast is in New York, which I believe is 5. But each run is different, so I think you need to have good information or at least a good preliminary assessment based on whatever information is available from folks that have credibility in that area.
Okay. Well, that kind of leads right into what we were going to do next. We were going to have Adam Kenyon get up and give what information we have in our data sets as far as recreational and commercial landings. Is that all right with you, gentlemen? I know you don't have the information.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Right. If you have any other questions, we're here to give you the insight that we have on the work.
And we appreciate if you could really look at this because, you know, the way they're hauling them out, if we have a, my biggest concern of all is having a bad spawn, a big temperature drop, flooding, you know, and the fish can't get up to the spawning areas or not in much quantity. Combine that with being taken by cast nets and dip nets, and hordes taking them, we could have some spawn failures and get in trouble again.
So I know on the phone you guys can't see the slides that I'm presenting right now, so I'll try and talk through them so you can get an idea of the information we have. I put together just a few brief slides that kind of gives everyone the context of the data and the information DMRC might have at their disposal versus anything that might be anecdotal. What you heard already from them is hickory shad are currently managed under ASMSD. There is no stock assessment currently for hickory shad, so there is no stock status determination. One item of note is there was a coastwide American shad assessment, and in 2010, the ASMSC initiated Amendment 3 to the FMP, and what that Amendment 3 required was the prohibition on the harvest of American shad. And with that, states, in order to keep their American shad fishery open, had to come up with some kind of sustainability plan, which included things like a monitoring program, a juvenile program, as well as a habitat evaluation. So, as far as regulations, Virginia does not have any recreational or commercial regulations. You can see here that Maryland is closed commercially and recreationally, as well as Potomac. I looked into the MRIP numbers for hickory shad. I looked through the last dozen years to see if there was anything in there. Unfortunately, in the areas that hickory shad are caught, there aren't a lot of intercepts. In fact, there are many years in the last 10 years that don't have any intercepts. There are a lot of B2s or throwbacks, discards. They range anywhere from 4 fish to 343 fish with standard errors of way over 100. So I didn't feel it was necessary to throw any, so we are very limited on the recreational data that shows up in our MRIP program. Commercially, you'll see on this graph, I'm showing 10 years right now of harvest. You can see back in 2009 and 2010, we were somewhere around 15,000 pounds commercially, 12,000 pounds commercially, and then when that moratorium or prohibition came in on American shad after 2010, you can see that precipitous drop in commercial landings in 2011. It goes down, and for the last 7 years, it ranges from 122 pounds up to about 3,000 pounds, and really is only maybe a dozen users to maybe 100 users. So it's not a very large fishery as far as what is reported. A lot of the other states, when the American shad harvest prohibition went into, because of the confusion between the two species, a lot of them closed down both fisheries to prevent that. So that's why you see a lot of this closure for hickory shad as well. As far, I couldn't break it down any further because of confidentiality, but if you look at a couple graphs on the right, most of the hickory shad commercially are taken out of the Chesapeake Bay, and then second, you have the Rappahannock River. And it's mostly a pound net or a gill net fishery. You can see the majority is taken out of those two gears. So staff, as far as what they're looking for from FMAC tonight, at this point, it's just a discussion item. No immediate action is required tonight, but it is at the pleasure of the committee if this is something they want to revisit, something they want to mull over or bring back, but there is no vote or action item that's actually required tonight. So I'm happy to take any questions from the committee.
Yeah, Tom.
What is the spawning run that people fish on these?
Spawning run generally March through May, somewhere in there. It's
okay,
water
so it's
temperature
awful,
dependent.
It's awful late in the year for us to be doing something for this year.
Right. It is late in the year for us to think about doing anything this year.
It would be nice to get some kind of creel limit on it, though.
Yeah. Do they mix with American shad?
Yep. The spawning runs coincide, so you do get a mix of hickory shad and American shad.
Okay. Yes, sir.
I thought regulatory was supposed to be based on scientific data, not just because some man wants to put a regulation in.
And I don't know if you could hear that question. He was asking, generally, if we put regulation on based on scientific information. And we don't have anything.
Well,
required for hickory shad. There is no stock assessment currently, and that's laid out in many.
You don't have anything to base the regulation on. You shouldn't have a regulation.
Well, we're talking about putting some science together for it before we do
that. After you get the science together, you might see that you don't need it.
It might.
These other states, the only reason they're closed is because the dummies don't know the difference between American shad and a hickory shad. I'm sorry, I tell it like it is.
It may be.
But if the situation is getting abused in the spawning reaches where these fish are congregating, especially if it's a pre-spawn and not a post-spawn abuse of the system, I'm concerned that we'll have a stock collapse before we can do anything about it. Especially if these are localized fish that will always come back to the same river, or do they come to the same general area and a James River fish will end up in the Rappahannock?
So one thing in the American shad assessment and the river herring assessment is all of these populations are river-specific populations. So all of the sustainability plans are done river-specific, not in general. So there's one for the Rappahannock, James, York, so on. They go back exactly to the
So if we get abuse on a specific river during the spawn, and these fish are congregated like that, it's easy to imagine wiping them out, and we'll be in the same situation as we are with American shad, where it's taken forever for them to recover to the point where we have a viable fishery again. Plus, you get your favorite topic of the blue catfish, which is coming up in the Rappahannock River. They aren't as bad as they are in the James, but they're there too.
Is it possible to go back and look at landings for recreationally for hickory shad over the past few years to see how big the increase has been?
They don't have data.
I'm just wondering
if they have any data at all.
What about DVIF? Do they have this species in their creel surveys?
I'm not sure. When you look at the MRIP survey, just to answer your question, Jeff, in 2012, we have observed harvest of 3,000 fish, and that's all for the last 10 years. And then our discards range from 4 in 1 year to 350,000.
So
the estimates are very broad. You can tell that by the error. So there's not many intercepts that come across hickory shad to get anything that it is valuable from.
The discard of 350,000, is that a recent year, or is that?
Yes.
Okay, so it may be increasing.
There's not enough information.
That's all
that means.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
They had an intercept.
All right.
And the 3,000 fish is probably one intercept of two fish, dockside.
They expanded out.
Not going to be much. But it would be interesting if staff could contact DGIF, because they would be doing creel surveys for freshwater fish in these same waters. And they may have some intercepts and some concept of what's going on. Like I said, I'm sorry, I am concerned about this. I do think that there needs to be regulation, at least some reasonable creel limit. And I don't know what the right number is. Certainly less than 20. Or 20 or less, but I mean, it probably is the right numbers on the order of 5. But I don't catch these fish, so I can't say. But there ought to be a reasonable creel limit.
That's his opinion. My opinion is we don't need a regulation, so everybody's entitled to their. The man said right up there that they're catching coolers full of them, so there shouldn't be no shortage of them.
Okay.
And there's these cast nets up against a dam or something of that nature. That would be a reasonable. But just to put some type of regulations and moratorium on them just because somebody else wants it.
Okay. Well, we need to get some background data, whatever we can find, and come up, make a presentation to us again, please.
Okay.
And see how bad the situation is, if we can determine that, and what needs to be done, if anything.
Okay. I don't know how much of that conversation on the phone you heard. But I think we have a recording of it, so we can get that for you. But I think what just came of this was to try and look into some other point of information that we may have, whether it be some creel surveys from DGIS. There's kind of a split point of view whether or not there should be some kind of reasonable limit on it, whether it be 20 fish or less, or whether we shouldn't have regulation at all, but maybe getting rid of cast nets might be something reasonable. So I believe the committee has asked staff to do a little bit more homework and see what we come up with and see if there is a little bit more information out there.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing that people need to understand is that the spawning area in the Rappahannock is very shallow, funnel areas, and it's not deep water. I mean, people wade out, so they have easy access, and they do get trapped in holes on the different things. So, you know, it's a spawning, shallow, rocky, you know, area that's very vulnerable to netting of any kind. I mean, it's not like being up against the dam. It's in a sense a dam of big boulders, and they have high ridges of rocks going across, and I actually watched the fish come up through those ridges. As a matter of fact, about 900 feet from the key spawning area on up, there's about an 8-foot waterfall, and they will stack up in front of the waterfall, and they can't get over that waterfall until like there's a high water, and people can wade in there with cast nets and fishing. And so, you know, and that's why I tried to get some, you know, geographic, topographic pictures. You know, this is a, you know, this is a unique spawning area in the sense that it's just loaded with pools and channel areas that you can put a net in that the fish have to go through. It's not like a broad, you know, wide river and they're just coming up. They're being funneled. And I really emphasize, you know, the funneling process. And just the question, can you put this out to, as a feel for how the community or whatever, for comments, so to speak, to, you know, to get other views of it? Is that a step that can be taken to try to, you know, get the visibility on it
later in the year?
Yeah, once we get some information together, like Tom said, we can't affect this year's season, but we'll have about a year to work on it, put some information together, share it with others, get other input.
So I think the consensus on that question, in case you couldn't hear, was we're already a little bit late in the game to really have an impact regulation-wise on this season, but we do have some time to get our ducks in a row and gather some information and reach out to some of these angling clubs to perhaps get a better idea of what might be reasonable that area to maybe decide a course and action in the future.
So,
I was wondering if we can, you know, if we can do the next stage for next, you know, the next year, to start gathering the data and get the feelers, you know, feelers out for, you know, what is the reason, you know, 2-4, 2-15, you know, 2-something. But to be on the conservative side, you know, and try to protect these, you know, these are spawning fish. They're not coming up to, you know, to see George Washington or Vicksburg. You know, they're coming up to spawn. And at times, you know, I'm there, you can catch, you know, fish every 4th or 5th cast, you know, when they stack up into the pool and we release them. But, you know, when a guy comes in and throws a cast net into the same pool, which is, you know, 14 feet by, you know, 20 feet, and he throws in 6 or 7 casts and wades out because it's so shallow, he just hauls them in, you know, by the bucket load. That's what I'm just trying to, and I'm not making this up. This is truthful. I'm ready to go to court. You know, this is observation on the water. I just want to emphasize that, sir.
All right.
It's our understanding that although shad, hickory shad can spawn multiple times, in our region, our understanding is that they typically only spawn once. And part of the problem is that it's not possible, really, to distinguish between the staging fish getting ready to spawn and those who have spawned. And so... it would be reasonable to take fish if they had spawned and they only spawned once, but since you can't make that determination out there in the water, it makes it much more difficult to decide where to fish, where to allow fishing, and how many to take. But collecting data and trying to get a better understanding of the situation and coming back and reconsidering it for future regulation, I think, would certainly be a reasonable approach. And I think a reasonable approach would be to limit the take to a rod and reel type of fishery so that there isn't excessive take by greedy people.
All right, we have one more question from the staff.
Two things. One to relate to these two gentlemen, because they can't hear me well, is I encourage them to go to the local fishing clubs and present this information to the local fishing clubs and have those clubs come back to staff with requests if they are interested. I believe they'll find that a lot of the fishing clubs, conservation organizations will support this. There are many species, spadefish and
fish with teeth.
Sheephead are species that VMRC manages not because of stock assessments. They manage them to have a quality fishery. And I think this is another species that we can look at that we want to manage to have a quality fishery. It's clear that at this point in time, the commercial fishery is not a problem. With the harvest levels you're talking about there, which looks to be a bycatch fishery strictly, that's not an issue. And I got guys in the back making funny faces at me. But the point is that the recreational, and this seems to be a situation that's getting out of hand. And I am.
Not you.
Okay. And and again, please convey to them that they really need to get the recreational fishing clubs to come back and try to support this. And for I strongly recommend that they stay after this with the commission and with this committee.
Right, we have one more committee member that has
just to comment to his point about the maintaining a quality fishery thing. If that is the goal, and I agree that is the goal in some species, if just make it a rod and reel only. Close it to cast nets in the spawning area or something is a possible solution, because a quality recreational fishery is usually not done with a cast net, I would say. So,
just to convey some of that conversation, committee members had a suggestion that you should probably take this presentation you have and reach out to some of the local angling clubs in the area and try and get their feedback on it and have those fishing clubs reach out to staff so that we can get the perspective of the people who may be using this resource, and we might get a larger inclusion of those kinds of people if that is something that you guys on the phone could do and reach out and kind of get a consensus or some feedback to staff from those local fishing clubs.
All right,
well, I already did that, Kurt.
Okay.
The catch and release people like me, fly rodders and all, they have the fly rodders, the friends of the fly rodders or whatever, the Rappahannock River, and, you know, it's probably 20 members or 30. The trouble I have is that the guy that headed that up and kept it all together and put it on Facebook, he went off somewhere, and the club just sort of dissolved itself, and there now there's the fly fishermen are just out there all over the rock, you know, from March to, but there's no consensus person I can go to. It's just sort of the club's disbanded, and each fly fisherman is out there, you know, on his own.
All right.
Their website, Salmon Fly Fisherman, they still have a website, but when I try to communicate with them, basically they are off of Facebook now, and I can't get a response back, you know, from a phone.
Okay.
So, I would have to rob the Fredericksburg and try to find, round up somebody.
We do have a lengthy agenda tonight.
I think we could. We're both members of the Northern Virginia chapter of the Coastal Conservation Association. We certainly can reach back to our group and pass the information to them. I don't know about other groups, but that would be a start, and we would. I certainly would try to do what I could in that regard.
Committee and staff, thank you guys for your time tonight. We do have a few other things on the agenda that we need to move through tonight. So staff will get back in touch with you guys soon.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you and good night.
Okay. So before we go, for the committee, there's a question about whether we need to mail out and email the announcements. Does anybody here still need or prefer a written mail, snail mailed copy? Apparently not.
We'll still try to get those to you 2 weeks in advance, which is a little short this time based on everything going on, but we'd like to get a few 2 weeks in advance if emails are okay.
Yes. Apparently so. You might query the people that didn't make it today. But.
Sure.
All right. Okay, towing of fish.
All right. Well, this is an update, and if you remember last month when you were here, you provided good input about this issue. Two main takeaways that from that your discussion was that really we need to do this surgically and focus on cobia and striped bass. And the other thing is that a number of anglers do tie fish to a stringer, keep them in the water to keep them alive, keep them fresher that way in some cases. And this is the definition we took to the commission that later that month. You met on the 9th. Commission meeting was on the 22nd, I believe. And they did approve a public hearing on this. And this is one of the things that I showed the commission. This is an example of a striped bass being towed. They put up a good water resistance, and hence they're tied pretty well to the boat. But one of the things, this new instance of striped bass towing, sort of a nuance, that people will put them on stringers. There's a very thin membrane right here between the jawbone and this lower bone here. And you poke that membrane, you get something through it. I don't think they even bleed. But because they really want to retain these large fish, they go in and that's part of the bone. They make an incision there. And that anecdotal information from other folks that were appalled at this, that's kind of a telling mark that they leave. But you got to ask, why are you putting them on a stringer and towing them? One thing, like you mentioned, is to keep them alive, preserve your catch. Another thing was, had anglers say, well, they thought they were doing the right thing because if they caught a bigger fish, they wanted to release the one they kept for the bigger fish, since they were only allowed one fish. And lastly, and I think a lot of what created the uproar in the month of December was some anglers have found that they keep it alive, and by towing at some speed above just barely idle, they're able to force water into the fish's stomach. And as long as the fish is alive, it seems like a lot of that water will stay in there all the way to the scale. And there were several big four money tournaments, and I think that was one of the things that really got this going. But that's an update. That's what I provided the commission. They did approve a public hearing. I don't know if you've looked at the commission's agenda, but we are going to ask for a delay, a postponement of that till the following month in March. And there's a couple reasons for that. The regulatory review panel met February 7th, and they quickly determined that they wanted to request a postponement of tomorrow's public hearing until March. This postponement will allow time for them to devise language to increase the enforceability of the towing prohibition. It's going to have limited impact, delaying it a month, since once striped bass season ended in the bay December 31st, the problem went away. I mean, there's no possession of the fish. And cobia season is currently not slated to open until June 1st, so it's really not going to create any problems. I had a couple anglers call me, said, "What, you guys dropping the ball?" I said, "No, we just want it. What we end up with, we want it to be as enforceable as possible." And so that's the reason for the request for postponement. And if they approve it, it'll be scheduled for their March 26th meeting. That's an update as to where we stand right now. If you folks have any discussions or comments you want to make, I see Mr. Avery
Captain Avery, who was at the last meeting, but we didn't, it was a long, long meeting, and this item wasn't even on the agenda. I see he's in the audience. He might want to add his comments personally to this. But if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. And
let's go to the committee first. Anybody?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman. Louis, there was some discussion last time also about a limit in terms of the size of the fish that might be taken.
That's a whole different issue.
Not going to be associated with this at all.
No, this is towing for striped bass. I think if you look at your agenda, they're going to talk about striped bass management, and I think that would be the time to bring it up.
With the picture you showed us of the fish being roped through bones, around bones in the throat, does that make it difficult for the fish to close its mouth?
I'll bet you that, I don't know. I've never been there and done that, but I'm sure dragging it in the pool, it's almost dragging a sea anchor of some kind. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of stress on the fish and those muscles. What I told the commission, I can't tell you or even begin to estimate what's the added release mortality on those fish, but I can guarantee you it's a lot more than a fish that's caught at boat side and then just put right back in the water. So if that estimate is around 8-9%, after suffering that, I'm sure it's quite a bit more.
If they were hooked through the lip or through that thin membrane by the lip,
rip the jaw out,
would the lip come loose or?
No. I mean, towing it like that?
Yeah.
You can look. It's not as solid as a tie-in point as there. Looks like that's right in a bony area. Right. So you've got both that bony part of the jaw and then the upper part of the lip, as opposed to just penetrating like this membrane and where you just are to catch the upper lip.
I would think if you're trying to preserve it, and you hooked it properly through the lip or through that membrane, that would be a lot better than for the fish, and you wouldn't be trying to put weight on it like hooking it where it holds its mouth open. There's no need, I think, to make that kind of a scar on the fish.
Well, if you've got a 40-plus pound fish, it could be a money fish. You don't want to lose that.
Yeah.
I don't think this is about protecting the fish from release mortality because somebody's going to turn it loose. There is an issue, and I'll fess up. I have a big cooler, and I'll fill it up with water and keep that water changed when I catch a 20-inch fish. And if I catch a 24-inch fish and I got two fish in that cooler and they're alive and healthy, I'll swap one out. Now, I've done it in the past. But the point is, when I fish in the kayak, they don't do that. The point is, you can, and there are systems set up to provide a flow of clean, fresh water over a fish's gills to sustain them, so that you could conceivably release them alive. And largemouth bass fishermen do this kind of stuff all the time, and there are techniques. But the point is, throwing it over the side and dragging it along like that is not. At some point, we have to say, you got a fish, you decide you're going to keep it. You may as well put it on ice and keep it.
Okay.
Exactly. All right. Anybody else?
Yes, I have a comment.
Yeah.
So, the Regulatory Review Committee, perhaps not all of you know what that is. So, in 2009, Commissioner Bowman, in his first time as commissioner, established this committee. And what it is, it's all divisions have participation and meet prior to any commission meeting, unless there's nothing that's substantive and they won't meet. But that's what the Regulatory Review Committee is. What the Regulatory Review Committee recommended on this issue, especially law enforcement component, was that this no towing applied to any species that had a possession limit. Lewis was not at the meeting, But that was the main thrust of the request for postponement. And the idea there was, at least specified by law enforcement, was that this comes closer to, you know, limiting the amount of culling or high grading, whichever you wish to call it, that it would sort of be an avenue to that as well. So that's really the big impact from the Regulatory Review Committee. And, you know, that's what the commission will hear, and I wanted you to hear that as well, that, you know, it's not just cobia and striped bass, it's any species with possession. And granted, cobia and striped bass are the two most often thought about for this towing situation.
Are cobia towed in the same manner that it keeps their mouth open?
I couldn't answer that question.
Okay.
Couldn't answer that question.
And would this cover a rockfish that was just on a stringer off a kayak?
If towing
continues to be defined as the boat is running and in gear, I would say no, it wouldn't count.
Okay.
A stringer in the water, boat at anchor, boat at drifting, wouldn't meet that definition.
The audience. Yes, sir. Come on up.
I'm Mike Avery with the Virginia Saltwater Sport Fishing Association. I will say, since the last FMAC meeting, we did put a poll on our website asking this question. And even though I have my personal opinion, our anglers are supporting having a ban on towing by like 76%. To 24%. So overwhelmingly, our anglers are saying they support this ban on towing, and we'll keep the poll running now that we have another month for the public, till the public hearing. We'll keep it open, but I don't really see our anglers changing gears between now and then. So our recommendation is that the FMAC support this proposed rule, and let's have a ban on towing, because that's what our anglers are telling us.
We appreciate that, Mark. Thank you. Anybody else? All right, I guess that covers that question. We're going to wait till after the public hearing and go from there, are we, or are we through with it?
That's it for now.
Okay. Mandatory recreation reporting.
All right. Good evening, gentlemen. I'll try not to keep you for too long, considering we have the meat of the meeting still ahead of us. My name is Ethan Simpson. I'm one of the new employees here at VMRC, and I prepared this presentation on the mandatory recreational reporting requirements. So I would like to start with the history of our reporting requirements for the recreational fisheries. It began in 1995 with the striped bass fishery, but it wasn't until 2015 that the current regulations were put into place. Cowfish and grouper were also added to the program in 2009 as a way for the VMRC to prove that there was a viable fishery for this that the VMRC could manage and to fill any potential data gaps that may exist. Also, as you know, in 2016, a mandatory reporting requirement was put on recreational cobia. In 2016, it was voluntary, and it became mandatory in 2017. Also in 2017, the requirements were made mandatory across each of the species for simplicity's sake. Worth mentioning as well is that in 2018 and 19, there was a February black sea bass seasoning that also requires its own reporting requirements. So to summarize what the regulations state across all species, captains and operators of vessels are responsible to obtain relevant permits and report for all individuals on board. Any individual fishing from a shore, pier, or man-made structure must also acquire the permits and adhere to the same reporting requirements. Failure to report any fishing effort for the target species within 15 days of the season closure, whether the fish were caught or not, or failure to report no activity in the fishery within the same time period will result in the permittee being ineligible to renew that permit for the following year. So regardless of whether or not you fished or not, whether you caught or not, If you fail to report within 15 days of the close of the season, you would be ineligible for the following year's permit. Some quick numbers about it. There has been some concern voiced recently that staff has heard about our reporting rates for these target species. Right away, you will notice that the topwater grouper numbers are quite low. However, beginning with those regulatory changes in 2017, we did see a marked increase in that reporting rate. You'll also notice that the cobia saw the most significant jump, but again, that relates to the fact that in 2016, that reporting was voluntary, and it became mandatory in 2017. But excluding the topwater grouper group, the reporting rate for cobia and the striped bass has been between 58 and 70% for the last 2 years. So currently, as the way it was written, as I've mentioned, the regulation states that reporting must be done within 15 days of the close of the season. However, in practice, we are the staff will actually accept reports well into the following year and up to the start of the new season, and that person would remain eligible. However, the computer will not allow, the way the system works, it will not allow you to renew a permit until a report has been filed for that individual. So they do have to report something in order for that permit to be issued. One potential way we were looking at maybe increasing this reporting rate is to adhere more strictly to that 15-day limit. However, when you look at when reports were actually submitted, and for this graphic, I'll point out that they are out of 100%. This is out of all reports submitted, not out of all permittees. When you look at these numbers and how they are submitted, the majority of people that do report, report within that 15-day period. In that first column, 60% for topwater grouper, 87% and then 67% for cobia and striped bass. You only see marginal increases beyond that date up to the start of the following season. Other than that, you really have the people that either aren't going to report or wait until they can't renew their license and report then. So the staff has voiced some concern that if we adhere more strictly to that 15-day limit, you may lose data. You may actually have people that just don't report at that point. If they're not going to get their license renewed anyways and they've missed that deadline, there's a real possibility that they just won't report. So with that in mind, and we're really looking for the committee's feedback on that as we move forward, but specifically we wanted to look at the topfish and grouper reporting rates that, as we mentioned, were quite low. Despite the implementation of the new rules in 2017, they have remained low. In fact, the last 2 years, it's only averaged 32%. So beyond the low reporting rates for the topfish and grouper, there's some other concerns that we thought of, that anglers are also reporting the same catch to NOAA's VTR program. This does result in double reporting. The staff does spend time answering phone calls, processing this paperwork, following up with fishermen, and at the end of the day, this program doesn't produce any unique data from the VTR program. Also, due to that low reporting rate, it's in the questionable nature of the data, it has not been used by staff to inform any management decisions thus far. So, finally, I would like to say that moving forward and tomorrow, what we intend to do is get in front of the commission and ask for a public hearing to eventually change the regulation to remove those mandatory reporting requirements moving forward. Just for tilefish and grouper, not for the cobia, the striped bass, leave those the way they are, just for that low reporting tilefish grouper.
Excuse me, point of clarification. Failure, your staff does not use the data specifically on tilefish and grouper?
Yes, sir.
Then why bother reporting?
That's kind of where we're at.
Why do we have double reporting the same data?
This predated the VTR program, and originally it was done to complement the MREP data and to confirm
the staff findings. Use the data that's reported directly to NOAA, or could the data be reported to Virginia and then transferred to NOAA, rather than having the captains required to report twice?
We could. Moving forward, with the removal of our reporting requirement, we would rely on the MREP data to inform
these
things.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Is the federal requirement to report the VTR data and the tilefish and grouper? We understand that there's not an assessment. capacity, especially since they've gone to EVPRs, you know, the electronic part. In the beginning, when we go back to Blue Line and go back to about 2007, the concern was that VPRs, that the reporting wasn't so great on the federal part. But that's not a situation that we have to worry about at this time. I want you to keep in mind two things. One, for first time out, that's a good job by Ethan. And secondly, tomorrow we should show the commission the percentage compliance by the reporting date of the whole universe of permits. So, for example, if you had 4,000 or whatever the number of COVID permits were by the closing date of whatever it was, what percentage was there? Because some of our percentages are misleading a little bit because they include times after the compliance date. The other thing that we'd like to tell the commission tomorrow is that we've given a two-year trial basis to where the commission went along with us not following the regulation to the T, in that if you reported, you could get back in, even if it was months later. Many, many phone calls. Jill has a list of it somewhere, of all the phone calls that we were getting of people just reporting. It automatically is an introduction of bias, because if you call for your permit and say, hey, where's my permit? And I say, we haven't reported. Oh, well, I'll report. I didn't do anything. Well, there's a source of bias. So we would like to enforce the compliance of the regulation now. And we would like to, if you don't report when you're supposed to, next year you don't get that permit. Come back the year after that. I think what Ethan did is pretty important, that maybe the 15 days or something like that isn't long enough. And so I hope the commission tomorrow will discuss whether there should be a little more time to report. We're going to have to advertise this like crazy, get it on the internet different times, get it out to different places. So it's going to be it's not a change. The regulation already exists.
How has it been advertised?
What's that?
How has it been advertised?
No, we have to.
I mean, in the past.
Internet. I mean, on our website.
When you get your permit, you usually get an email telling you what the regulations are, but that's about it. Yeah.
Okay, but when you buy a regular, like, a saltwater fishing license, it's not.
No. But when you get that permit, you'll get an email telling you you just got your black sea bass permit. These are the requirements on the list of requirements.
So,
but to answer Bob,
my question is, I don't fish for cobia very often, but do I need a cobia permit to go cobia fishing? I didn't even know that.
Yes.
So
yes,
maybe you can say the same thing.
I didn't know that. I mean, okay. And I didn't look at it on y'all's website that I needed that.
Yeah,
so
targeted something.
I feel like on the process, because everybody has to go online. If you do it at a tackle shop, they go online, mm-hmm. or you go online to buy your fishing license, whether it's a boat license. I think it would make sense for the commission to have that. Do you plan to cobia fish this year? Click yes or no. Yes. Are you aware you need a permit? Here's how you get it, and here are the requirements. I would do that for all these things, because I honestly was not aware that would be our role.
Well, that's why I said we need to advertise this in multiple places.
Well,
we have
the time when people are buying a fishing license makes the most sense. Because
yeah,
I would
have
been like,
we have discussed that we can get to the agents and have the agents have that information.
So
we haven't done that before, so it's going to be sort of a new process.
So I always buy my license online. So when I buy my license online, why can't it be that the piece of paper that I print out that's got the copy of my license on it has three sentences on the bottom that says, the following fisheries require a permit. Cobia, not tile fish anymore, but black sea bass if you're fishing for them during this time frame. And that just is part of the piece of paper you print out. And now, when you buy a license from an agent nowadays, do they just have a laser printer and print out your license? So it would be the same thing for them. When they hand you the piece of paper, it's not a little teeny square. It's an 8.5x11 by piece of paper that's got written on there. Here are the permits you have to have to target these species during these times.
Right at the moment.
It's a
very
good idea. But the game departments are...
Yeah, but I can't imagine that not being something that can be put into the system.
Right.
it's no cost to anybody but the guy who has to change the program for the actual printing out the document.
We have to work with the Dam Department to give suggestion. In the meantime, that's probably not going to happen by copia season, for example.
So one of the things I would recommend, that one of the things staff use some kind of money from, maybe recreational license money or staff money or agency money, to print out some outdoor compatible signage and put it up at marinas and boat launches that say fishing for cobia and black sea bass require these permits, especially cobia, because people,
please don't forget that it's in regulation, and regardless of the fact that we're all busy and you have a chance to look at regulations, it's in regulation.
But it's a fairly new regulation, and
it's unique to the recreational fishing
license to go fishing. So
we've already had you call us and ask us about the regulation, I didn't fish or something like that. But we'll take your concern in effect. They're good suggestions, okay? But in the immediate future, we just have to figure out to make people aware that, yes, there is a regulation. It's going to be a compliance situation. So please report. I think the sensible thing is that the commission can say, well, 15 days is pretty quick. Maybe we can make it a month. That you have to report. And then we put something on our website, something on Facebook. You know, we'll figure it out that way. And eventually, Tom's suggestion is the right one, that when you get your license, your saltwater license, the information is there printed out for you. So,
well, it's sort of just a checkbox. While you're buying your license, before you click submit with your credit card information, say, do you plan to go be fish? Check yes or no. And if you check yes, another line pops up.
Yeah.
Here's how you get your permit.
You come work
click here. Well, I'm just saying, that's right.
It would
be nice to sit
for a
moment.
I'm not like a computer guy with a code. Because I would have been pretty upset if I had got a cobia ticket and I didn't even know the cost thing.
Well, I guess the point is, do you know the fishing regulations? You get your license, then how would you not know this?
Because I look up the minimum size limit and
it's at the same place. It's at the same place. All these regulations are listed under recreational regulations, every single one of them. If you know what the flounder rules are, if you know what the tall tog rules are, if you know what the speckled trout rules are.
On the little card that
they're on the regulations that Lewis does. They're on the website to list all the regulations. It's there. It's been in every newspaper. It's been in magazines. It's been on every website.
Lewis says it's on the
It's on every publication you've done.
So we're trying.
Okay.
Doing what about license?
We're through at the table, I guess. I hope.
I have one question about the specific changes you're talking about making. I do think it's still a good thing to be able to, even at the last minute, do your report. And I think 45 days, by the way, is the right number for how long you should have to make it.
Okay.
But the real key is to stress. If you don't report and you lose your permit and you don't get a permit the next year, it's a 1 year penalty.
Yes.
And that's what you make sure it gets stressed. But is there any way you can make it so that, you know, we want your report in 45 days and it has to be in here in 90 days or something? When does it matter to you really that the report is here?
Because of the bias, there's different types of bias in reporting. And reporting on time, if you report on time, it's different than if you report much later. You know, there's like four types of bias that we figured out as far as reporting bias. And the worst one is if you don't report, but then you have to call us to get a permit and make your report. Well, an average person is going to say, I just didn't fish. They're not going to be bothered with going back and saying, yes, on June the 20th, I fished, and, you know, the data's not going to be the same. That's the problem. But maybe 45 days is something reasonable.
All right. And the other question is about the mandatory reporting for cobia, especially. Is it doing us good with, I guess it's ASMFC now. So yep. Now they believe this number, if this is what our harvest number is and not the MREP numbers?
They use their weight. Yeah, they took our weight instead of the Southeast Regional Office weight. So that was a big plus.
So it's worth it.
It's worth it.
It's a nice article to have on your webpage.
You know, the COVID update, Erin, we'll have another meeting to give you an update on COVID, on where the landings were, the harvest was, and what the ASMFC plan is, and
I really do think that this would be a really good article to get put in the Bay Journal or something like that, to get it out there that the agency has made this change because we're trying to understand, get better data, and that the data is considered very, very good, and that people are making use, and that it is of value to the fishermen to have this data in there.
Okay.
And Bay Journal is a good place because that ends up getting spread out other places.
All right, thank you. You do give out a notice at the end of the season that they have 15 days to report, correct?
Yes, we do. They get emailed.
Okay, thank you. Were there some comments from the audience?
Mm-hmm. I have one.
Yes, ma'am. Please come up and tell us. Come up and tell us who you are. Thank you.
I'm Teresa Barnes. I just wanted y'all to think about the lifetime saltwater fishing license. If you add that in, the people that have that, you have some kind of special regulation. And also, if you build something, you can build something with electronic signature. You know, when you're giving out the permit, whether just like he said, there's a little boxy check that you're saying yes or no, that you know that these are the rules, that you have to have a special permit, that you're signing up for that at the time that you're getting the renewal of the permit for the people that do that renewal.
All right.
Good idea. Thank you.
Challenge for that.
Okay. Anything else? Just one name from the audience.
My name is Wes Blow, a recreational fisherman. Just some comments about the reporting. You know, if you wait a whole season of cobia fishing and wait to report 45 days afterwards, you might as well just throw all that information away. It's useless. I fished about 26 times last year for cobia. I caught 176. And if you ask me 45 days later to report my catches, you know, you're going to get a bunch of garbage. So to wait that long is just a waste of time. You know, it needs to be sooner. You know, the black sea bass thing, we have to report that day. And that's easy to do. You know, people that say, oh, I can't report, well, don't go fishing. You know, if you can't report it, just don't go. You know, to wait that long, you'll never get good information.
And it's a shame that we have to do this, but it is necessary.
It is necessary. And if we want a fishery, we need to do it. I was never supportive of doing it. But I've realized that if we want to continue to have fisheries, the public has to get involved in helping with it.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Okay. We're through with this, I guess.
Okay.
Dry bass stock assessment.
So we have something to hand out, and Alex is going to give you a presentation, but I wanted to update you from last meeting. So we all love the idea of a maximum size, but after that, I think everyone realized that the proposal from staff is to keep working with the committee to bring you information that might be conservation measures, some which you've seen before, some which you haven't. But I think you'd be surprised that after the meeting, I had one person, Scott, say, hey, you know, in the commercial fishery, you ought to look at a mesh size for the gill net rather than a max size because you're going to have too many discards. So surprisingly, in 2009, the commission did entertain a maximum size of 9 inches mesh for the gill net in the coastal area and 7 inches in the bay, but they ended up doing 9 inches each area. But that went away pretty quickly because there's been no mesh size for several years. So that's one new event there. I think the other thing to tell you is There were concerns about being unilateral, but we have reached out to every state so far. I wasn't in last week, but we reached out to Delaware through North Carolina. It seems that most states want to see an amendment process out of the ASMSC, which is a long process. I'm not sure that that's the best process. If you do an amendment, it's about a year and a half easily. If you do an addendum, it's possible that something could happen in 2020. Some of the northern states will particularly probably push for an addendum. The reason there has to be action is the stock is one coastwide stock that's being looked at, and there's overfishing is occurring, and the stock is overfished. Amendment 6, which is still the viable amendment, says if you have 2 years where you're over the target fishing mortality rate, you have to take action to bring the fishing mortality rate to or below the target. I don't know if it says immediately, but something close to that. So the ASMSC hasn't made up its mind. At the last meeting in February, all the information wasn't in. There was that partial federal shutdown, so NOAA wasn't able to present the peer review, where they have a group of scientists that are independent of the stock assessment people. We didn't have that information. We have that now. We've looked through that. Staff has. And the ASMSC will look at that collectively with the management board, the striped bass management board, in May. So although there wasn't any immediate call for action, Alex will have one slide which shows that there was a motion for information to be gathered before the May meeting. So that's the way things stand. Staff hasn't changed. We want to continue to work on proposals with you. It'll be an ongoing process, and some of them may not stick. Some of them may. Some may help. I want you to keep in mind when you see some of Alex's percentages of conservation on what reductions would be, that they're strictly in terms of the harvest. Some are pretty low, but when you consider how the fishery's been, especially the last 3 years, it's been really low too. So you have to keep that in mind. We need time as well, because we don't have a stock assessment scientist on staff. We just don't. We never have had, except for one, and she went to North Carolina. So in the future, it is for your future that you help the agency by whoever you manage to be friends with out there in the General Assembly land to encourage a FTE, which is very difficult to get, of a stock assessment scientist or two. This agency has only secured 3 new positions since the mid-90s. And Alex is one of them. Jill has the second position with the quota monitoring. And the third position was a computer position that it didn't go out very well, didn't work out too well, and that position's not even there. So we have two since the mid-90s. But, you know, there are states that have a group of stock assessment scientists. North Carolina has a group. New Jersey has a group. Massachusetts has a group. I haven't thought about the other states, but they're the three most notable. And the reason I'm bringing this up, it's not about a harvest reduction. We have to consider everything, dead discards. So some of the information is that Addendum 4, which was what we've been under since 2015, when it was all said and done, dead discards in the recreational fishery are greater than the harvest. So the idea that we all raised our size limit on the recreational fisheries, it didn't work out so well. And so, you know, you have to keep that in mind, that what we have to do as a staff, and we're going to have to borrow from VIMS, we're going to have to borrow from North Carolina expertise, we have to show what will reduce the fishing mortality rate from our contribution here in Virginia on a coastwide basis, as well as what will increase the spawning potential. Those are the currencies that are looked at in stock assessment. For Addendum 4, when that went out, the ASMSD said, here are ways that you can go ahead and conserve, and it's going to be a 50% probability that you'll reach the target F, a 50% probability. Didn't work out. I assume something like that will come back. If you're concerned about what measures that we all end up with, then what we have to tell you is that there is conservation equivalency. So last time, we didn't have much of a chance. They wanted to reduce the quotas by 20 or 25%, depending on bay or coast, and they wanted to reduce the recreational fishery, and all were by the 2012 harvest we had. So, you know, we didn't have a chance for conservation equivalency. By that, to give you an example, if you decide you want a different size limit than what the ASMSC says that you can increase or decrease by, whatever it is, then if you can prove that it's equal to that measure, then you've got equivalency. So we've got a long way to go. Staff is going to need a lot of time as we go through this. I hope that we can just continue on a monthly schedule for a little while. There certainly is interest to have, I've heard a few of you talk about it, and we've talked about it too, to have Marilyn join us to do something. Since we were together from 1997 to 2014 with the Potomac River Fisheries Commission in a bay-wide quota. So that interest is there. I don't think the comments we've gotten back from other state directors are that supportive of doing something quickly, but the ASMSC is all about, you know, votes. And so when it comes down to the votes, if there's enough votes that say we want to push ahead with an addendum, I sure hope that they do the right thing. I heard one comment which disturbed me at the ASMSC, which was from a northern state saying, well, heck, we'll go to 32 inches. You know, we'll go up to one fish at 32 instead of one fish at 28. The problem with that is the dead discard still. And when you have a year class like the 2011 year class, when it started a little trickle going out on the coast at age 4 and more on 5 until age 8, they're all out there. But before they were recruitable size, you got a lot of discards there. But there are a lot of discards in the bay, too, and we haven't had a chance to look back. But for whatever reason, Virginia never, in the recreational fishery, never seems to have a lot of discards compared to other states. We're usually about, you know, third lowest or something like that. And I remember looking at this information back when we had a special committee in the past, and we just don't seem to have high discards. Maryland's got very high discards, very high harvest. So, you know, I just wanted to let you know that we're moving ahead, just like we said we would. We want to move ahead with you as a committee. And so realize as these options come forward that we want your input, and that'll help us out too. But we'll have more as we go forward, you know, more ways to look at this. We really are just getting started. So thank you.
Any questions from the committee?
Yeah. Are you saying that the Virginia commercial quota has not been going over?
No, it hasn't. Matter of fact, it hasn't been reached in about 4 years. But what's going over?
We need more restrictions.
Because we're under a coast-wide measure. That what was done was that there's a coast-wide approach. All the states are lumped together. There's overfishing, and the stock is overfished. Now, the thing about Virginia, which is different than other states, is Virginia has always been pretty much 50-50 with the recreational fishery. From 1997 to 2014, when we had the bay-wide quota, it was always 50-50. The commission made a decision to keep it that way. In some of the recent years, the commercial fishery is a little stronger than the recreational fishery in the bay. So it's not about Virginia. It's about all the states together from North Carolina up to Maine that are in this situation. And a trigger has been made. There has to be action by the ASMSC. All we're worried about is how quickly they want to act and do they want to have the right measures that we can fit into.
Virginia came up with the initiative to come up with a program that would not go over. So now we're still being punished because other places look like maybe they need to do the same thing we did. We wouldn't have a problem.
Well, at the bottom line, they took away our Chesapeake Bay quota. So in with Addendum 4 in 2014, which went into effect in 2015, it removed what we had before. We don't have that anymore. It's gone. And that's the problem of what happened with Addendum 4.
Are you telling me again that we don't have a quota?
We have a commercial quota. Right now it's based on whatever was in Amendment 6, and we took a 20.5% cut in 2015. That 20.5% reduction is still in place. What I'm telling you is that in a coastwide approach, no, that's not enough. We're part of the management unit of all the states from North Carolina to Maine.
Well,
and there's overfishing. Yeah, well, I don't know what the answer is yet, but let's go through some meetings.
If I was you, I would kind of push that Virginia took an initiative to protect the quota, to protect the fishery.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. I'm not sure what you mean by that, Bobby.
There are other states that did.
All the states had quotas. Commercial quota. Some states don't have a commercial quota. Connecticut, New Jersey, they don't even have a commercial fishery. But there are commercial quotas, so they could say the same thing that you're saying. They took quotas to protect the fishery. So, I mean, but bear with us. Bear with us.
The General Assembly told them to kiss the butt, so why don't we do the same thing?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's go through this and, you know, after May.
They proved that North Carolina's done it, New Jersey's done it.
Right.
All we got to do is everybody stick together and quit supporting them northern states up there.
Yeah. What'd they do? What North Carolina and New Jersey do?
Oh, we are the incubation period place for those people up there.
We are a nursery area.
Yep. I talked about it, Scott, and I told him what's in Virginia water should belong to Virginia fishermen.
Yeah.
Not let some New York bunch up there tell us what to do with our fish.
If you know, when we all started, and that's a good comment, because when we all started out on this baywide approach, it was for resident fish, 18 to 28 inches. That's what the whole harvest control model, all the quotas are built on, 18 to 28 inch fish. But guess what? It's not like we fished on 18 to 28 inch fish.
And the trouble with ASMRC is they regulate, but they don't know how to regulate.
Yeah. Well, I think the trouble is that time wasn't taken to get the right measures last time. Someone in the stock assessment world should have said, well, wait a minute, if you just raise the size limit by 2 inches, those fish are still going to be caught and released. All the 18 to 20 inch fish are going to be released, and that can be a big problem. So, and then they go on the coast when they're larger and they're not quite 28 inches, they're going to get released as well. And I think that's what we've seen on the recreational fishery.
It happens on commercial fishery, too. Every time you tell me I've got to throw a dead fish overboard, you're wasting your resources.
That's why we'll look at mesh sizes. We already have some data from VIMS. We're looking at that. But again, we're going to go through this step by step.
Did I hear you say, I understand that you've met with Maryland, Delaware, Potomac River Fishery Commission in North Carolina. Did I hear you say that all of them are against doing an addendum?
Would rather see an amendment for various,
For
various reasons. One, you can't, you know, they don't like the biological reference points. And you can't do that by an addendum.
Theoretically, so they're waiting for an amendment to include, is there delaying holding for the an amendment that would include biological reference points?
That's part of it. I mean, it does take an amendment to do that.
I understand that.
The rebuilding objectives or goals, it takes an amendment to change that. You know, for example, they might want something different than 2 years over the target fish and mortality rate automatically triggers rebuilding. So it depends what actions they see as viable as needing an amendment. And they're a little bit different, but I think the general theme is they would rather see an amendment for different reasons.
If that holds with all the rest of the states, we're 2 years away from seeing any action on this.
Now, keep in mind these are sort of my counterparts, so there's always a level above me. and levels above that. I mean, so this turns into, at some point, a political process at some point. But right now, I just canvassed my counterparts in those states or that jurisdiction, and that's what they came back with. So.
Thank you.
Yep, you bet.
All right. Good afternoon. My name is Alex Aspinwall, and this is a review of the striped bass stock assessment and discussion on conservation measures for future management. So first I'd like to start off with a little bit of discussion on the background. What are the results that led us to this point? We're going to go over the assessment, and we're also going to discuss some proactive recreational and commercial management options for consideration. Nothing, like Rob said, nothing has been set in stone at this moment. It's really just to start the discussion and really get the ball rolling. So the 2018 benchmark assessment was completed and peer-reviewed by a stock assessment workshop and a stock assessment review committee in November of 2018. The board did receive preliminary results that indicated that the stock was overfished and that overfishing is occurring. The board did receive a motion. I'm going to put down the board real quick. It was to task the technical committee with providing the board with a report that shows the reductions in harvest needed to reduce F to the threshold and to the F target, and to also provide one example of a recreational bag and size limit combination needed to achieve these conditions along the coast and in the bay, and those results will be provided to the board in May. Rob O'Reilly also suggested that we suggest some season closures, because what happens more often than not when you have a reduction, they want to increase the size of them, and then we get into that dead discard situation where we have dead discard spike. So again, so that will be provided to the board in May. They will decide whether they want addendum process or amendment process. Addendum, if we did have addendum, we'd have public hearing this summer. Then they would vote on final action in October of this year. If it was amendment, much longer process, be about 2 or 3 years. We would have final action probably 2020, likely 2021. So right now I'm going to go over the stock assessment and the peer review. So the 2017, the Management Board tasked TC and the Stock Assessment Subcommittee to develop stock-specific reference points. They developed four models. We had a two-stock model, which was the premier model, the model that they really pushed forward. It actually gave reference points to the Chesapeake Bay and to the Delaware Bay and Hudson River combined. They also had a three-fleet model, which was the same model used in the last assessment. It just included data through 2017. There was a two-fleet model, which was an improved three-fleet model. It had a better grasp on commercial discards, and an ASAP model, which is the same type of model that they used for the summer flounder stock assessment. The peer review panel went over the assessments, all four models, and they recommended that we continue with a single-stock model with one set of coastwide measures for reference points. So looking closer at those reference point values, the 2018 assessment was still used in 1995 reference year to establish threshold and target values. You'll notice that the 2013 assessment and the 2018 assessment, that there's a noticeable difference between the two, especially in the spawning stock biomass, has large part due to the incorporation of the new calibrated MRF estimates. But for the purposes of this assessment, we will be using these reference points for spawning stock biomass and fishing mortality to assess the status of the stock, whether it's overfished or overfishing is occurring. So looking more in depth in fishing mortality, the dashed line represents the fishing mortality threshold at 0.240. You'll see that in the early 90s, fishing mortality steadily increased. It exceeded the threshold once in 96. We stayed below that threshold for a handful of years, and it wasn't until about 2003 that we hit that threshold again. And from 2003 to about 2018, that 15-year time period, the fishing mortality estimate was either at the threshold or above it for at least 13 times. And the terminal estimate, what I mean by that is the last mortality estimate in the time series for 2017, that was 0.307, which was the second or third highest mortality estimate that we've seen in the entire time series. And because this estimate is above the threshold, that would indicate that the stock is experiencing overfishing. For spawning stock biomass, we see that spawning stock biomass is increasing through the 90s. Once it hits 95, this is when the stock is declared rebuilt. That's where the threshold comes from. We go above that threshold for 2 years. We dip below it for 2 years. And then we stay well above it until about 2010. We start to see a decline in spawning stock biomass. And then we exceed that threshold, and we've been below it for about 5 years, from 2013 to 2017. And when we look at a similar year, when we had similar levels of spawning stock biomass, that's similar to about 1992, which is only a handful of years after we had the moratorium. And a few years before the stock was even declared rebuilt. So because this spawning stock biomass is below this threshold level, the stock is being overfished. Now, changing gears a little bit, we're going to look specifically at recreational trips and harvest specific to Virginia from 2003 to 2018. The blue bars represent the directed trips. The gray bars represent the harvest. And the orange line represents the CPUE, or pounds per trip. From 2003 to 2009, you'll see that the trips and the harvest and even the CPUE fluctuate quite a bit, but they stay over time relatively consistent. It's after 2010 that we start to see a decline in the number of harvest, trips, and CPUE, to where in 2018 we have one of the lowest levels of CPUE, harvest, and directed trips throughout the time series. Looking at commercial harvest of striped bass, specifically by gill net from January through June in Chesapeake Bay, the commercial fishery is monitored very closely. So when under addendum 4, when we had that 20.5% reduction, you'll see that those pounds drop drastically. You also see that numbers drop. But what really stood out to us is that you'll see the average weight decrease. I mean, 15 years ago, it was about an average 15 pounds, and we dropped to 13, then 12, 10, 9, and then 18. We're down to 7 pounds at the average weight. There may be a few reasons for this. Commercial fishermen may be able to easily achieve their quota by targeting small fish. Maybe that's easier for them, or maybe there's just not as many large fish out there, and they're forced to target smaller fish. But we are seeing a decrease in the average weight. When looking at the coastal area, we don't see that trend. These seem to be much larger fish. We don't see that decreasing over time. In fact, it actually looks like it's about 18 pounds overall. So next I'm going to present some conservation measures. Again, I want to remind you this is really just for discussion purposes only. Nothing is final. We just want to receive some feedback from the committee. So the first option is to allow one fish per vessel to be greater than 28 inches in the Chesapeake Bay area. So currently the possession limit is 2 fish per person in the Chesapeake Bay. Minimum size limit is 20 inches. And only one fish of the 2 fish possession limit can be greater than 28 inches. So this option will still allow you to catch, or anglers to catch, that very large, fish of a lifetime. But at the same time, we generate savings from when people would take trips and intercept more than one large fish. So if you have a fish that's beyond 28 inches, you can keep that fish, but if someone on your boat catches another fish that's maybe 44 inches, then you would have to release that fish. So the savings are really specific to those large spawning fish. And And when we look at savings, it's, you know, it's not a lot of savings, but it, you know, again, these are specific to the spawning fish. It's about 1% to about 1.5%. The second option is to eliminate the bay in the coastal trophy season. So currently, striped bass must be 36 inches or greater to harvest during the trophy season. So when we looked at the trophy data, it what's reported to us is not a lot of fish. When you look at 2017 harvest, it's only 226 fish were kept. I'll just wait. It's okay. Yeah, no, that's okay. Yeah, so it's not a lot of harvest. When we look at 2017, it's only about 226 fish were kept. 2018 was only about 176 fish were kept. And let me explain this. These are fish that are expanded. There's a reporting rate with this. So it was actually smaller than this, and we expanded it to 100%. So on average, it's about 200 fish. And when we include the fish that died due to hooking mortality, it's about 300 fish. And then when we compare that to the grand scheme of things, it's only about 0.25% of the total harvest. Again, these are large fish. These are very large fish. 70% of all these fish were greater than 40 inches. So this is an option that you know, we're presenting, and we'd like some feedback on it. The third option is to establish a one fish possession limit from December 10th to December 31st for the Chesapeake Bay area. Currently, two fish are allowed per person during that time. So it would be during this short period during December, 2 to 3 weeks, that your possession limit would go from 2 down to 1. And in terms of total savings, this generates the largest amount of savings we see out of the recreational options. It's about 9% in 2016, 5% in 2017, about 7% on average.
How this measure was in effect in 2007. This measure that Alex was going over, we had in 2007, back when we were trying to slow down the harvest of striped bass. So now we're not trying to slow it down, we're trying to build it up a little bit. But this is one of the measures that we had in place. The fishery was very big from 2003 through about 2006 or 2007. And we had a couple of things that Tom should recognize definitely that we had in place before, including the no-take slot that Alex has showed.
A fourth option is to establish a November 1st through December 31st no-take slot limit for the Chesapeake Bay area, whereby there is no harvest between 28 inches and 34 inches, but one fish can be 34 inches or greater. Currently, one fish is allowed to be any size greater than 28 inches. So in many ways, it's very similar to our season size and possession limit right now. However, if you were to catch one fish above 28 inches, that fish must be 34 inches or greater, not 28 inches or greater to keep. And so we're really generating those savings by not keeping those fish between 29 and 33 inches. And when we look at total savings, it varies by year. But on average, we're looking about 4% of the harvest occurs during within that size limit. And so moving on, next we'll discuss some commercial conservation measures. The first one is to shorten the commercial season that starts on January 16th. So this option wouldn't necessarily reduce harvest, but it is possible to reduce the amount of reduce the harvest. There may be less fish around dependent on where we change that season. And so if you look at harvest by month on a two-year average, you'll see that within the Chesapeake Bay, most of the commercial harvest occurs from January to about May. There is some harvest towards November and December, but for the most part, that's when the bulk of our harvest really occurs. And when we look at average weight, these are usually smaller fish, about 6-7 pounds on average. When we look at the ocean, almost all of our harvest occurs in April and May. I think if we were to look back 5-10 years ago, you'll see that there was more harvest in the beginning of the year, but now harvest has really shifted more around April and May. with just a little bit in November. And these are much larger fish, on average about 22 pounds. And so the second option is to establish a maximum gill net mesh size for all areas, the Chesapeake Bay and the coast. Nothing has been determined at this moment, but there has been in the past. We did have a 7-inch maximum mesh for the bay and 9-inch max proposed earlier. The next option is to establish a maximum gill net mesh size from March 26th to June 15th. This would be to accompany the already existing 28-inch maximum size that already exists for the Chesapeake areas and Potomac Cribs, and make sure that there's adherence to that 28-inch max size limit that's already in place. And the fourth option is to establish a 36-inch maximum size limit in Virginia tributaries of the Potomac River. So the Potomac River Fisheries Commission already implements a 36-inch maximum size limit for gill nets from February 15th to March 15th, and this would just further complement the conservation measures that are already in place in the Potomac. And this is really a summary of the four options that were presented. I gave you a handout earlier. On one side, we'll have the four recreational measures. And on the other side, we'll have the four commercial measures. And so, you know, at this point, the floor is open for discussion, and we just really want to hear your feedback on some of these options, and if there's any of these that you really would like to see proposed, or what your thoughts are. And that's all I have, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Yes, please.
For the commercial striped bass fishing, you have to have a quota. You have to have tags. Once you reach your quota and your tags, you can't catch anymore. Well, what am I missing here? Why do we have to have a mesh size or fish size or a season? I mean, I understand the tags aren't ready till January, but you fish year-round. Once you get your quota, you're done. You can't catch anything.
And you're going to fish harder if you close. Can you put back up the numbers when you show the by month?
I agree with you,
but no, the by month commercial harvest. So if you close, for example, February, which is a really big harvest month, all that's going to do is push that effort into March and April. And so, I mean, you have to have a conservation reason why you would want. Now, one could argue conceivably that you want to close January and February so that the spawning fish have a chance to get past the nets or the fishermen and up into the river systems where they can spawn, and we want to harvest them on the way out. But these fish are older fish that we need to come back year after year, so we need conservation measures across the board.
How many commercial striped bass fishermen are there?
About 400.
Okay. And each 400 has a certain amount they catch. And there has to be a reduction, reduce each of them by whatever it is, 4 or 5%. There it is. Why do you have to have these measures for the commercial sector? Am I missing something? Do I not understand this?
No, you're not missing anything. I think the idea is, if this has any practicality, it's based on the size of fish. So if there's any savings, it's fine for them to take their quota. But if there are less large fish taken to get that quota, since it's a weight quota, then that may prove more beneficial. But the real issue is in other areas that Alex showed you. So, for example, we have a maximum size from March 26th to June 15th. Guess what? I was surprised it's not adhered to very well. We have a sampling program, which is only part of the story of what fish are being taken. But, you know, years ago when I was looking at this carefully, a lot of fish are under 28 inches. So that's an area that would be more practical than something like this. The only benefit of this approach is not to take away quota. It's to look at the difference between having small fish make up that quota as opposed to larger fish. And is there a time that that would work. So we don't have any good information on that at this point. But the other thing that you bring up, Mies, is the quota itself. Now remember, we already had our quota cut. So if there's a proposal to cut the quotas again as part of the ASMSC mandate, then I hope we have some ammunition to say we don't want to cut the quota. We're going to do other measures, such as the 18 to 28-inch slot, which isn't upheld very well, and other commercial measures, such as the 36 inches in the Potomac Tribs, which law enforcement has told us many times that it's a real problem to work with two close jurisdictions with harvesters who have tags in both, where you have a 36-inch max in the Potomac, but yet we don't have the max. So those are the real issues that we think would be worthwhile. But we can't forget, ASMSC may have a blunt approach to this and just say, again, okay, cut your quotas. Now, the dilemma about that and what we've been under since 2015 is when they cut the coastal quotas, we took a hit because we had to go by what the data were at that point. There were other states that the ASMSC decided we won't take 25% of the commercial coastal quotas from the 2013 harvest. We'll take it from what Amendment 6 had as the quotas for the states. The reason they did that, there were a few states who were way underachieving. North Carolina had zero harvest for 2 years. So the 25%, and I asked Alex to look this up, the 25% reduction ended up being about a 4% increase. So we've got to be careful about these quota cuts.
The average pound for the bay is 7 pounds. And
the average reported weight for the bay is 7 pounds. We all know the system that we have. We had a system which was based on numbers of fish and average weight for every gear type. And we were hammered for a number of years from the upriver fishermen who said that they didn't have access to the bigger fish that the main stem bay fishermen did.
Right.
We went to an individual weight quota. So now we have a situation where you report your weight that you harvest and your number of tags. Is it perfect? No. So is it 7 pounds? We don't know exactly.
Right.
So.
And you said there's a problem from that March 26th to June 15th with
the 28
over 28 being tagged. That, I don't feel the rest of us should be penalized for that. That sounds like a law enforcement problem because each fisherman has the tag registered to them. It's their number. So if they're putting their tag in a fish that's 30, 36 inches, that's an admission of guilt that they're doing something illegal.
But we have to figure out a way, that there's less probability that they can do that.
Right.
Even though, because law enforcement can't be everywhere, you know that.
Right.
They've got roughly 30 officers on any one given day for the whole state.
Right. I mean, I think it's not too smart of a person to put their own tag in a fish that's illegal.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem very intelligent to me, but I didn't know that was going on.
Well, some years it's not a big percentage. Other years it's a pretty fair percentage. So.
But I'm with me on this. We're just going to shift effort to different areas. I don't see.
Who said that?
They've got quotas.
This is what we want to hear from you, okay?
Right.
But keep in mind, what I'm worried about is ASMSC is just very blunt and says, okay, everyone reduce your commercial quotas. Now, we're just talking commercial right now.
Well, that's why I'm wondering. ASMSC is telling Virginia, you have to reduce your commercial quotas. There's overfishing happening in Virginia. But the commercial quota had been met in 4 or 5 years. So the commercial fishery is not overfishing.
The commercial fishery in Virginia is different than other commercial fisheries because of what I said earlier. We generally, up until the last few years, have been a 50-50 relationship with the recreational fishery. The stock assessment determined that only 10% of the removal, which is harvest plus dead discard, is attributable to the commercial fishery, 90% to the recreational fishery. But in Virginia, we can't say that. So we actually are in a little different position than a lot of the other states that made up the 10%, because we're not 10%. We're more than 50% the last few years. So it's something you have to think through, but the bottom edge of this is that it's still, they rejected, you know, Alex didn't spend a lot of time because there's a lot of information he's worked on, but they rejected our approach to have a Chesapeake Bay only stock-specific management. And they said, well, it's very interesting, but we don't think it's ready for management use yet by the ASMFC. So now we go to the fallback, which is the two-fleet model. And essentially, you've got a Chesapeake fleet and you've got a coastal fleet, but we're all under those pretty stiff reference points that Al showed you. The spawning stock biomass went up. Granted, the fishing mortality rate improved a little bit if you're looking at it that way. It went up to 0.24. So we're all lumped in there. But it's very tough to make the case that Bobby made, and I know his intent was correct, that the commercial fishery generally has kept their quota, but we are more than 10% of our recreational fishery.
One thing about option three, if we do decide to go to that, it may be a good idea to, from an enforcement standpoint, to put the same restrictions of a one fish per person limit on the coastal waters too, because you get people fishing right at the mouth of the bay and they'll go in and out and in and out, and that could get tricky from an enforcement standpoint.
Can you bring that up, Al?
Isn't that the limit now?
It is. That's the limit now.
Oh, it is the limit now? Okay.
Right.
Yeah, we haven't caught coastal rockfish since about 2000.
I know.
They're just not there. They're offshore.
Yep.
Crazy question. Our dead discards come from releasing fish that aren't in slot sizes. Is that where they come from?
It comes from all released fish. And it's a survey number, and it's 9% of the survey okay. number for released alive fish, or released alive or dead fish.
So it seems to me like slot sizes are the problem. I mean, why do we have
the released mortality is not high on these, and in Virginia historically, and it would be interesting to see these numbers the next time you present about striped bass. In Virginia, historically, we've been kind of a one-third to maybe one-to-one release dead to caught for the recreational fishery, whereas Massachusetts, it's like 10-to-1 release dead per caught.
Here it comes.
So this is, I prepared this and I expected this. It's the average removals, so from 2016 to 2018, of fish harvested. Fish that die due to hooking mortality that are released, and the removals by state.
Yeah, so you look at Maine, and they're it's yeah. 10 times as much.
And I think it's easier, actually, if I get to the next one, it's actually in percentage, so you can kind of see who's contributing where, or who's contributing the most. So Virginia, I mean, overall, we're you know, in terms of removals, pretty small compared to someone like Maryland or you know, Massachusetts.
And a great deal of that is from high grading, I would think.
For Maryland?
They don't.
Anywhere.
For Virginia? Yeah. They
don't count it that way.
Yeah, no, but that's
and
one of
no, those. They don't. From a reality standpoint, you may be right. I'm not going to debate that part of it.
Okay.
But from a mathematical approach to counting fish, they go in and they say, how many fish did you catch and throw back? How many fish, and that's one number they catch at the dockside survey, how many fish did you keep and what to measure them? And they use those two numbers expanded by the fictional number of recreational fishermen to get the actual harvest.
But still, if we're going to try to address the problem, we need to talk about high grading.
Well, we are fairly conservative on our discards, as I said earlier. I mean, it's about 1-to-1.
Yeah, it's a 1-to-1, 3.6 and 3.84%. It's kind of the same number for Virginia for the recreational harvested versus
released that end up dying fish.
The
and they can be released and end up dying because you have them in your cooler on ice and they were dead when they went back, or because you hooked them and the hooks just went the wrong way in their gut.
Okay. And if I may make one other comment, so you look at Virginia and you look at those percentages and you say, well, heck, we're not doing that much. But the flip of the coin is, do we really want to be in that position? We were either one, two, or three for many years running through the 90s into the early 2000s for recreational fishing, as far as our rank went. So it's...
And that was harvest numbers, though, but not harvest plus dead discards.
Yeah,
they started counting harvest plus dead discards in the last 4 or 5 years.
Okay. Anybody from the other side of the table? Comments from the audience?
I have a question.
Please. You have to come up so we can record your name.
Hey, I'm new with this, so I'm just looking at numbers.
You're doing
all right.
The summary? Or?
No, the series is like from 2000, 1990s on up.
Right, so are you looking at, effort and harvest in Virginia? Or
Okay, so my thing is, if the earlier years, if there was no quota, or if the quotas were different, then as each year the quotas got less, of course there's going to be less fish. That makes sense.
Less quota.
Right. If you have a high quota, you got more fish, you can catch more fish, got a higher number. And then this year, you got a lower number, you have less fish. So what other data, what other comparison do you have to show those analysis of quota versus the early years versus now?
She's right, because we took a 20-25% reduction.
Right.
So the numbers have got to be...
Right, right. But, you know, you would expect... Even if you did have a cut, that the fish, the actual fish, their size would not decrease. You wouldn't be catching smaller fish.
What year do we switch, Rob, from tag?
2007.
There you go.
2007. That's it.
So that's a lot of time. It's a lot of average weight is going down.
Mm-hmm. We also, which is one of the complications, they have some observer data that they use in stock assessment. I haven't dug into it yet. But gill nets don't have, well, first of all, recreational harvest is 9%. So anything that's released alive, 9% are assumed dead.
Okay.
Gill nets, for anchor gill net, has always been assumed to be 42%. So if they have observer trips in certain places, they'll expand that to gill net fisheries, and we haven't even touched on that yet to look at that.
But I don't see how, with going, I can see having dead discards before when it was a tagging system because everybody high graded, but with a pounded system, I don't know why the commercial quota would have any dead discards anymore. There's no reason. They're not going to be undersized. The guy's fishing a 7 or 8 inch or 9 inch gill net, it's an 18 inch minimum, and the price is usually pretty good for 2 to 4s, 5 to 8. So there's guys that used to tag all 20 pounders are now tagging 2 to 4 pound fish.
The one way it happens is one way, which is not a major thing, but you know, there'll be harvesters who will say, I've got to fill my quota, and unexpectedly they do more than their quota.
They've only got 1,000 pounds of quota and they catch 2,000 in their quota.
And they weren't expecting to.
But typically, it just happened one of Seafarm's boats tagged out. He called 3 or 4 other guys who went and tagged because one of my boats got fish out of his net, so to prevent fish going back dead. Other boats went and fished his gear, so I don't see where the dead discards for commercial.
Yeah.
I don't know how we can
refigure
that.
Right,
that should be well down, I would think.
Well, what they do, and I'm not up on it, Alex might be up on it, I used to be up on it, but they use a tag-based system. So essentially, they have recreational reporting rate for tag fish, and they have the commercial harvesters who report tag fish, and then they do a ratio essentially and come up with the dead discard. How good it is,
right?
It's never been terrific. That's why the two-fleet model, I think, is better than, at least for what we got, for the fallback, is better than when we had three fleets. Because they put commercial discards in its own component last time around, 2012. So, I mean, but we haven't dug really far into this. Right. This information wasn't released until, I think, a week ago. You know, the peer review and everything else. So,
all right.
We're still digging.
Gentleman in the blue shirt, please.
My name is Charles Dryden, and I am a commercial fisherman and a rock fisherman. The reason your weights went down was because you switched to quota. As soon as we went to quota, you didn't have to have the 20-pounder, the 25-pounder, the 30-pounder. Everybody went, split up and went everywhere, went in the rivers and everything else. That's why there's no more big fish. That's what's going on. Everybody's like, oh, no, we got to do something. You don't have to do nothing. It took care of itself. As soon as you went to quota, everybody's going by price. Don't nobody want to catch big fish no more. No more spawning fish because they're not worth enough. I can get more in the coming up here in the middle of May. I can get more for a 3 to 5 pounder than I can for a 25 pounder. I can tell you right now, probably $1 a pound. I don't want to mess with them. Don't nobody want to have a thing to do with them. But you can't cut them out because there's some people that's what they catch. They've got the nets to catch them. They don't want to switch nets and everything like that. But them saying there's no more big fish, that's crazy. Number two is these fish are coming in on cycles, and they're coming in on the moon. Back in like 2007 to about 2014, your full moon was on the 1st of March. Every year, and then years, it was the 1st of March. Them fish come in on the backside of the full moon. And it's going to happen this year. It happened last year. A week to 2 weeks after you cannot catch them no more, they're going to show up in thousands of them. A couple guys left a couple, 8.5 down there, filled them full, hundreds of fish. And went down there, got them out, and stuff like that. But that's the whole thing. They're going off all this landing data, same thing with the croakers the other month. Well, there's plenty of croakers, there's croakers everywhere, but there's no big ones. Well, we first started off, we wanted plenty of small ones, but now every time something happens, when everything's running smooth, we've got to change the target where we don't have no big ones. So we got to do something about it. Well, at first you wanted small ones, but now you want big ones. But the big striped bass are there. They're there. But just the people trying to target the fish aren't there no more. I mean, don't nobody want to go in the middle of the bay like on a day like today when it's blowing 35 to 40 miles an hour and fish nets looking for a big fish when I can go up James River or Rappahannock or Potomac where it's halfway calm net underneath the shore and fish nets. And it's just crazy they keep coming up with this stuff. It's like every time you think you're going right, because for years and years, everybody wanted us to catch small fish. Leave the big ones alone. Let them spawn. So then we say, okay, let's leave the big ones alone and let them spawn. So the year the young's been up, from what I understood here, a couple years, 2 or 3 years, everything's going fine. And then they throw this on you. Hey, there's no fish, there's no big ones, because nobody's catching any commercially. That's crazy. I mean, it's just crazy. But that's the reason the average come down, and it's probably still coming down. Because my average right now, I can tell you right now, for this month, is 4.2 to 4.5 pounds. That's my average. And I catch 2%. I got my cousin with me, he catches 2%. And that's what I average. If we get a high average, it'll be 5 to 5.5 pounds. But that's why it's coming down. Now, all down from about Magic Bay down to, I'd say, Reedsville, all them guys are still trying to catch the big fish. Why? I have no idea. It must be because they don't want to change. And then another thing about big fish is you burn up a lot of quota. I mean, you don't have to go through a lot of little fish and stuff like that. If you catch 200 fish, they're 20 pounders, that's 4,000 pounds, correct? Well, heck, you can get that many in a single net when they show up and if they do show up. But like I say, what's been going on is that is they've been coming in later. And the price hadn't been worth a hoot, so don't nobody really care about it. Because I've seen them go all the way down to $2.25, and I can go get small ones and get $3 for them. So it don't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. But that's what's going on with this. I mean, they can put the numbers up and everything like that and tell you you're doing wrong and the recreational, I don't know what they're doing and stuff like that. But the commercial, this is what's going on.
Yeah.
But as for the mesh size really don't matter. About every proposal y'all had on here is the same thing that Maryland does. Maryland's got a 7-inch, Maryland's got can't have no fish over 36, the same old stuff. I mean, we don't have to do everything that Maryland does. I mean, our fish is okay, like Mr. Amy said, there's really no need to mess with it because that's what's going on. I mean, it's not like they're all dying or anything like that or somebody's been killed. They're there, but nobody's trying to catch them.
But after we get through the May meeting of the ASMFC, we can probably have a better idea of what's intended because certainly even the commercial quota hasn't been reached for
right.
5 years.
Exactly, but somebody needs to tell them, hey, they're not targeting these fish no more. Exactly what y'all wanted. Because I know they were out there in Virginia because we went to the big tags and half of them were black tags where we couldn't catch any of those over 28 and everything like that. I've done that fishery. If you caught a 16 pounder, you threw him back. I mean, it was awful. I mean, the best thing to ever come out was individual quota. Because like I said, if 16 pounder, 15 pounder, 10 pounder, no, you didn't care a damn lot of what. You threw him back because you had to have the heaviest fish that you could have. I mean, it was just crazy, and what y'all done when y'all went to the quota, y'all say, oh, but.
You have good information, and I hope that you and I know the committee appreciates that if ASMFC establishes a mandate, we don't have much
room. Yeah, I know that.
Room.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do through this process, which is this is just the start tonight. We're trying to get a better handle on what measures we might have that we would be able to say to ASMFC, we don't want a cut in the commercial quota. We can do these measures and we can satisfy what's called conservation equivalency. That's what we're up to.
Yeah, but sooner or later, you've got to look at it and say, I mean, come on. I mean, it's not happening here. You need to take care of the states that's doing
it. What size are you going to do, Fish?
I've got all. I've got from 9-inch to
5.
On average, right now, 5.5.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Appreciate
that. Sorry, we've got another question up here. And
so one of the things that would be useful information from staff, not necessarily today unless you happen to have it already, is for the other states on the coast, what fraction of the commercial quotas for each state that has a quota is actually harvested and what is not. I mean, I think that when you're talking about problems with the spawning stock and you're saying, well, for the last 10 years, we've only caught 80% of the commercial quota. I don't know what the number is, but say it's that number. Well, if we have to cut the quota back because of the spawning, because we want to get the spawning stock improved, which I feel like the recreational fishery is pretty much dismal right now. It has improved up in the Upper Bay, but it's not like it was in the 90s for sure. Then we have to take cuts, and it has to be from the way we're harvesting now and killing fish now, not how we would had hoped to be when we set the quota. There's a certain fraction of the quota that will never be caught because people have a quota and they don't sell it, or they think they're going to use it and they don't use it. It's just the way the numbers work out. But the real bottom line is the fishery is the fish stocks are in trouble, and or not in trouble, but going down, and we need to see what we can do to get them to go back up.
Well, that's a good suggestion, and we will look at the performance of the coastal commercial fisheries. But Maryland's number one, Virginia's number two, Massachusetts number three, and I think all three have pretty much over time harvested most of the quota. But we'll look at all the states that have a commercial fishery.
Chris?
Yeah. Chris Lefford, commercial fisherman, recreational. I do have been a little bit of everything over the years. some of this I know is not going to go anywhere, so I've got to narrow down on a couple things. You know, and they're not going to listen to this, but, you know, in 1989, we put a moratorium on. We were in the face of science and biologists that said, hey, we just had one of the best spawns ever. This fish grew up. You know, there are a lot of, you know, larger fish that maybe aren't in the fishery anymore. You know, some things just don't live forever. I mean, they're 40-year-old fish. You know, they were spawned in 88. They said we caught them. We had a heyday in the early 2000s. You know, right now there are more fish 16 to 20 than I've seen since 1992. And I was fishing in 1992. That's the beauty of getting old, is I can actually remember when I was 22 years old, I had a good perspective of what I was catching and fishing. So, not as much knowledge as Mr. Weegley, but, you know, I've been around. You know, so it's kind of nice to be able to say, hey, you know, I remember seeing this. And, you know, a lot of rockfish issues are cyclical. You know, the spawn is a big factor, how they spawn, the success of spawn. None of this is going to make a difference to the ASMSC. I understand that. That's what's frustrating, is that, you know, they're going to ask us to make changes on something that I think if we give it time will change itself. The fishermen have adapted. Fishermen aren't fishing because the success is not there. Commercial fishermen are changing what they're doing because they want to be successful, so they've gone down in gill net size. We've done things voluntarily to keep catching fish, just like Mr. Dryden's doing, you know. And I told my fish buyer, hey, this is going to happen. But one of the questions I have, you know, and again, like, none of that's going to fall on deaf ears at ASMSC, and that's the shame of it. But one of the questions I have is about this 28 inches being exceeded in March through June. You know, I'm really curious from Mr. O'Reilly of how he's finding that knowledge. What's the maximum size or the minimum size you could send in New York, Scott?
The minimum is 28.
So the minimum is 28. So, I mean, there's ways and times that you can only possess those size of fishes. You know, so it seems to me that even though I know we only have 30 agents, that maybe we should look at the bottleneck of where those fish are and the supply, and if you got them and the tags in them, like you said, you know, get to the bottom of that. You know, there's a lot of quota that's being caught in Virginia waters and processed in another state right now. We're not getting any benefit out of it. Our packers aren't packing them. Our trucks aren't trucking them. Our buyers aren't buying them, but they're coming out of Virginia water. And who's up there watching them? You know, who's watching what those folks are doing? And I'll just say it, in Maryland. You know, I mean, a lot of our quota has gone by, you know, gone to Maryland and being caught by Marylanders. It's Virginia quota, Virginia licenses. So anyway, you know, I don't know if that's the area that's happening, but there's got to be a paper trail, and there sure is a fish trail, and it's an easy one to follow. The agents don't have to go kick in the bushes. They just got to go look at the supply chain. You know, and so I'm just curious how are you getting that? Where are you getting that information on that this, you know, 28 inches being exceeded? I didn't know how are you at liberty to say, or
from our sampling program.
Sampling program. Yeah.
I mean, that's not a full approach there.
Yeah. I mean, sampling commercial harvesters and looking at the fish they're harvesting. Yeah. Interesting. Well, it's you know, it's something that, you know, I don't know how big of an issue that is. I mean, if they're 29, I'm not trying to make less of it. You know, there's a law I should be adhered to. I just was curious how that information was gathered. I don't know. We'll go back. I'll talk to my people and, you know, talk to, you know, different, you know, we'll see. I see what y'all are up against. You know, I see where this is going. You know, it is unfortunate. I could tell you in the fishery, and I want to make sure that we emphasize this, that we are tagging and keeping everything we catch. You know, if we catch it, I don't care whether it's a haul seine, hook and line, gill net, you know, we've done that. We haven't discarded fish. I have not since this fishery started. You know, when I went out that day, I've been very lucky to fish with people who mentored me on how to use certain gear and target different sizes during different times of year in different locations. We've been very responsible about that because not wanting to go over. So I really am proud of our, you know, performance in that. And even the recreational side, you know, when you look at compared to other states. But anyway, I think we've been doing a good job in Virginia. I think a lot of it is cyclical. I think people just need to, I'm seeing right now exactly what I saw in 1991. And if we wait 5 or 10 years, it's going to repeat itself. I've never seen the amount of fish that's been. Throw a cast net in Lynn Haven and catch 5 20-inch striped bass right there in the inlet. Trying to catch mullet. And caught five. I got pictures of it. I can show you. Flopping around the deck in a cast net trying to catch mullet. The fish are coming. They'll be back. We've had some great spawns in the last 10 years. Have we had some good ones in the last 10, 15?
Well, you know 2011 was good, but you mentioned 89. So 89, 93, 96, 2001, 2003, and then 2007 was the last above average until 2011.
Right.
But it's been average since then.
Yeah.
Or slightly below, because for some reason they were able, to my surprise, at the February ASMSC meeting, they did something that's been wanted for a long time, combining the Maryland Juvenile Abundance Index and the Virginia Juvenile Abundance Index. I haven't read how they've done that yet because it was just released. But, you know, so we're close to average or a little bit below since 2011.
Sure.
But, you know, that's not bad.
No, no.
We just don't have the monster year classes that we had in the 90s.
Right. And this fish reached the maximum age. I mean, nothing lives forever, folks. You know, we had a good time. It was great. You know, nothing lasts forever. Fish don't last forever. You know, we all took part in it. It just, you know, got to be patient.
Yes, please.
Can you put up the slide that showed the recreational harvest by state?
Right here.
Numbers or percentages?
Percentages. Read better. Yeah, percentage. So I just want to reiterate the comments that I made at the last FMAC. I am all in favor of conservation measurements that Virginia should take, but I really strongly believe that we should take it as a coalition of states and not just Virginia going it alone. Look at these numbers here. You know, we're 3% of the harvest. So if the other states don't go with us and we jump ahead of the states, and Virginia takes some measurement ahead of an addendum or an amendment, all we're doing is taking 3%, and what, if you cut it down to 2%? So to me, that is statistically insignificant. We're not really saving the stocks by going from 3% to 2% or 1.5%, while the other states continue to take the 97% of the harvest. And we're taking just a small portion of that. So Virginia going it alone is not going to do anything other than make us feel good about ourselves. We're not saving the stocks. So let's work this as a coalition. Let's work the amendment process, the addendum process. I don't really care. Or even if we take the other states and they do it voluntarily ahead of an amendment, I'd be good with that. If we even got Maryland to go along with this, we'd be accomplishing something. But just Virginia doing it alone, I'm against that. And I don't think we should consider it.
Appreciate it. Rob, the target that they set, is that based on what we called in the 90s, or with the size of the stock in the 90s, or?
The biomass target, the 40 stock biomass, that's based on 1995, although they're also looking at 1993, which is a little less as far as, you know, being conservative, a little less conservative. But listening to Mike Avery, I mean, yes, we are small, but there's one thing, and I haven't looked for a while, but we talked earlier tonight about hickory shads and about the Olocenes and about how they're faithful to the home stream, how they come back to their rivers. What I remember is striped bass is not like that, but striped bass is faithful to the system. So it's not as if the striped bass don't come back to the Chesapeake Bay. But you know, I'll definitely need to brush up on looking at that. But that is the case. Now, that doesn't mean they come back to Virginia; they can go to Maryland. But they you know, they aren't home streamers, but they're system dedicated, so they have some fidelity there. So, you know, you factor that in a little bit. And I'm not promoting anything. I'm not saying anything differently. I'm just saying that depending on how you look at this, there can be conservation, even if we're this low percentage at this time, which the flip side of that, again, is that the percentage we really want to be? Go back 12 years, 13 years, 14 years, when we were harvesting more than Maryland, and we were worried because we were afraid we'd go over quota. We had a recreational quota. If we didn't calm down the fishery, which the words then, slow it down. Now we're about 10% to 15% of what Maryland is harvesting and then look at the dead discard. So, and that's up there for you right now to take a look at that. So, I mean, it's not a direct situation right now that we're facing. You know, it depends on what you think is best for Virginia, and we'll know better after May which direction the ASMSC wants to go. If they want to go an addendum, we'll probably be doing something by 2020. If they don't, we don't know. And then Pat brought up something interesting to me today, which I hadn't thought of. It's possible to get an addendum underway to try and get the fish and mortality rate down, but at the same time be initiating the amendment that takes care of the rebuilding goals, the biological reference points, and other factors. So, I mean, that's a possibility. I don't know. So, but some of the states are going to be pretty antsy about doing something. So you look up there, we know New Hampshire will be, Rhode Island will be, Connecticut could very well be. So, I mean, Delaware could be, but Delaware, in fact, at least my counterpart in Delaware, thinks everything's fine, stay status quo, don't do anything.
Everything that I've, a number of articles that I've read over my many years about wildlife is that when you drop down to a low like we did in the 80s, there's a peak that you reach when you recover, and then it levels out. Should we really be setting our target based on what the peak was? Is it really realistic to think that we can get back to that and maintain it?
Well, the reason the stock was considered recovered in 1995 at that biomass level was because the ASMSC and its technical committee kept looking at all the information, and the plan was when the average of the 1960 to 72 spawning stock biomass was reached, victory was there. And that's what happened. In 1994, right before 1995, the technical committee told the board, you've reached that amount of spawning stock biomass. So that's why 1995 is in there. Now, is it realistic that it should be 1.25 times that? Some think no. Even some stock assessment people have said no, you need different biological reference points. And you saw what Alice had up there. I think he had now that we're looking at a target of 114. Thousand, you get that's right up there in the 91. It's jumped up quite a bit, Jeff, so I mean it's become even more elusive.
Right, so the spawning stock biomass jumped from 72,000 metric tons to 114,295 metric tons.
That's coastwide.
Coastwide, correct.
Yeah. It's Emirates, New Emirates doing a little driving.
But if you had to back calculate all the data, so the numbers that we used in the 90s would have been higher, wouldn't they?
Right.
The whole benchmark for everything has gone
right.
up because of this new mythical
number of fishermen.
Chris.
Mr. Wheatley hit on something again earlier. You know about the disparity between what we do and how we. Abide by the rules in Virginia versus New England. They've been doing this to us on flounder. I get up here again, I say it again, and I'm not going to quit saying it. I've watched New York and New Jersey consistently exceed their flounder, and then we end up paying for it. You know, we meet our requirements, we play good, we do the right thing, and then we get punished for it. You know, I'll never forget sitting here 10 years ago and looked at the discard mortality in Massachusetts. And they don't have any limit on commercial. Anybody can sell rockfish up there. And they're killing them and throwing them away. They kill more than we caught in Virginia and Maryland, I think, that one year. Who really did this? And we continually take it, I look at this tonnage and I look at our even harvest, our consistently even or even a dip. Yet these other places, if you look at independent, what they've been catching and killing has kept going up and up. It's never enough for them. It's never enough. They get ready to do it on us with a commercial flounder quota. I don't know what the answer is, but one day we gotta be treated fairly.
Rob, one other question that I had. I didn't hear anything about reducing our dead discards in the recreational sector. Is that not worth pursuing at this point? I mean, circle hooks, all kinds of different things that we can do. Why aren't we looking at that now?
Well, Maryland last year dropped from a 20 to a 19 inch size limit on the basis of using circle hooks. But at the 11th hour, the Charter Boat Association said, we're not going to be doing that. You know, we're not going to go to the circle hooks. And Maryland took some heat about that at the February ASMSC meeting, but that's all. They just took some criticism and that was it. But yeah, circle hooks are great. The comment that I made that Alex put up there was, and I don't mean it intended for Virginia, but as a whole, at the board, they were talking about having changes in size limits, changes in possession limits, and if necessary, season. And so what I said at the ASMSC was, well, if you close the season, the only dead discard you're going to have is from catch and release, and plus you do run the risk of some recoupment, because when fishermen get pushed into a narrower fishing season, they're going to be ready to go as soon as it opens. And, you know, you'll have this recoupment effect where they're going to make up for lost effort, lost time. But that's why I mentioned the closed season, because they almost had it as an afterthought. And so the woman who's head of the technical committee said, well, we've never really analyzed anything about closed season. And I said, well, that's fine. When you get a chance, it might be good to see that. Because I'm totally against this idea of playing around with size limits because of the dead discards.
Well, Maryland went to circle hooks in different sizes to reduce throwbacks, but that failed, if I remember the numbers correctly.
It did. I mean, they had a very small percentage gain depending on which data was shown. It was very sketchy as far as the amount, and I think that's because, you know, the charter fleet didn't participate.
Well, maybe it shouldn't have been an option.
It just didn't work out.
John, did you have some?
No, I'm good.
Anybody else? All right, is that it for current business?
We're back to the grindstone. We'll be back working on things and take your comments into, you know, our group as far as maybe where we go next, what we look at next. And really, as I said in the beginning of this issue, we need to be able to tell you what we do decreases fishing mortality rate and increases spawning potential. That's what everything's going to end up being all about at the ASMSC. And we need to have things for the ASMSC when and if they go addendum or amendment or both, whatever they do, that we can have conservation equivalency. That we don't necessarily have to take the, you know, what everyone else took, what they did with addendum 4. Everyone on the commercial side took the cuts. Everyone on the recreational side did the size limit. And we struggled back then because we didn't even have enough recreational data. We had to put 3 years together to figure out what it'd be like for us to go from 18 to 20. So data drives everything.
All right. Any old business to come before the committee?
You know I do.
Robert?
You don't have a report on a catfish experiment.
Which one?
The one with George Trice.
I think it went through, Pat was there, I think it went through the FRG, the Fisheries Resource Grant, as a proposal.
Yeah, but how many more years are you going to study that?
How many more years left? I'm sorry, I better get up. There we go. Wow.
What's that?
Can you elaborate on what's happening?
What was the question?
How many more years are you going to do the catfish study before you go ahead and do something about the catfish?
Zero. Zero more years. We are going to work with Bob Fisher, and we're going to come up with a strategy to come up with a way that we can have, I don't know what the answer is, how many we'll have,
but to have more than just one operation going.
That's the electroshock fishing?
Yes, electrofishing. And don't have details because I haven't had a chance to see Bob. He was away and then I was away. But that's what we're planning to do. It's going to be complicated, as you probably can guess, as to how you figure out who should be part of that electrofishing. If you remember the good old days of American Shad, when we had 10 harvesters helping with brood collection, and we had criteria that they had to meet in order to be part of the 10. We don't have the same situation with this, but you know, we're going to work on it. It's going to be very limited. Does it become a gear license? It probably should, because that will free things up. And then I know that Bob has an idea that if there's an electrofisher, then there should be the traditional fishermen, the hoop netters, able to participate in the chase boats and be able to, you know, partake of that electrofishing, you know, indirectly, not be using the electrofishing themselves. But to do that, we're going to have to be creative to figure that out, because the code is very specific on having a gear license to be able to sell your catch and things like that. But I'm definitely thinking about all that. I haven't sat down with Bob yet. This is something we're going to be exploring, and it'll probably be 2020, but that's why I say zero more years of experimentation, because I don't know, but I don't think that the current proposal will be approved. So I hope that helps you out.
If you go back to the Virginia Code 28-1.202, it says you have jurisdiction over all fin fish up to the thaw line.
Yeah.
That's how you got to stress to them.
Yeah, and I know you've done that. I know you've done that with Delegate Peace in the past.
And if I have to, I'll go back to Delegate Peace again.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Well, we've got to do something. We know that. Again, I think last meeting someone said someone was dragging their feet a little bit, but no, this is on our minds to get something going. And it's good to have Vims, and Bob Fisher has a lot of experience. He's done a lot of really good things with the commercial fishery. So stay tuned.
I have two other people.
You've got me down there eating up everything.
So, two things with the electrofishing when you start really serious looking. First thing is, how many, and I don't say a specific number, but are you talking about each river gets like 5-10 electrofishermen?
No.
Is it a larger quantity?
We've got to work it out.
But if it's not many,
right.
And the other thing that came up in the GET meeting when we had a lot of different user groups coming in talking about the goal, NOAA Goal Implementation Team for Ecosystem Management, is there are specific areas that are recreationally targeted for the really large fish, and there is a concern that the electrofishing will mess up that fishery to a certain extent. And so there may be some, and the electrofishermen were all for this concept of, here's areas that you can't electrofish, here's areas that, you know, the rest of the river you can, but these specific...
They don't take the large fish.
That may be true.
You're talking about avoidance, that once there's been a shock applied, there'll be a certain time where the fish won't respond favorably to hook and line or other methods.
Yeah,
I understand
so,
that, and we'll take that into account.
Yeah, and so there are areas that are heavily fished recreationally for blue catfish that there's a desire to not allow the electrofishing in those areas.
We're going to work on this, so we'll keep the committee informed. Again, I haven't quite figured out all the details yet, but that's why Bob's going to help, and he'll be really... a good part of this.
Do you have one more question?
Looking up and down the panel here, we seem to have lost our commercial presence. Saw Doug. There used to be a fellow down there who was a pound net fisherman for a while.
Walter's still around. He just couldn't be here tonight. Walter Rogers.
How we re-up the commercial presence on this panel, if that's a possibility.
I mean, the committee is interesting because the committee was formed in 1989.
We used to have FMAC, which was Fisheries Management Advisory Committee, for everything. There was one committee. And then in 1989, became a finfish committee, shellfish committee, crab committee. There was even a hard clam committee at one point. The situation with FMAC was, up until the last few years, very dedicated to their own sector. And, you know, a lot of times issues would come up and the commercial, you know, members wouldn't even bother to vote on anything recreational, and vice versa. I mean, there was that polarity. I don't see that anymore, so I'm not sure that that is something that would go away just because there's not right now another commercial member, but we'll certainly look. We've got one, two, three. We have, you know, and then we have Walter, that's four. So we will look.
I guess everybody shows up.
Yeah. But we'll look and make sure. It is good to have a balance, but what I'm impressing on you is that the FinFish Committee has become more engaged in all issues in the last few years, which is really good.
Absolutely. So. And we briefly talked about if we've got to do something with Spot and Kroger, forming a subcommittee on that, is that something still on the table? When do we have to come up with something?
Pat will probably take any ideas you have on that. If you've got his email address. So if you want to get that started, is that something you're ready to?
Yeah, I'm ready. We have to give a summary at the May ASMSC meeting about what I mentioned last meeting, just, you know, what our thoughts are, what would be an acceptable measure that we'd be willing to try. Nothing, you know, just to get a feel for it. So, I mean, I got
something we could probably do with this committee versus forming up.
I mean, if we want, we can form a work group, that'd be great.
But we should be able to handle it in this committee if we had the time.
But the problem, handle it within this committee, but the problem is getting a pound net fisherman, getting a Hall of Fame fisherman, getting hook and line fisherman, gillnet, getting that diverse group, because that's who it's all going to affect. I just want to make sure everybody's represented in that at all.
Yeah, I'd say just work through that with Pat, and then he'll know, you know, how to go forward with that.
Okay.
So. I think it's a good suggestion.
It is a trawl fishery, too. Even though we've stayed out of it the last few years, in years before, it's been a big trawl fishery.
The experience that the commercial fishermen bring to the table is critical, I think, because they see things that we don't see. And so I think it's very important that we have a balance. And good people, which I know Ernie's up because he had an operation. So
yeah.
I'm not blaming people.
At the last meeting, me wasn't here. Ernie wasn't here. It was just Robert and I was looking around feeling all this commercial stuff's coming down. There's nobody commercial on here. So that was my concern with making sure we get a balance.
Yeah.
I talked to Plumley the other day. He wants to know what we're going to do. He wants some ideas. I mean, and we got options to do framework, you know, and it's a forage fish. It's not like we're managing top-end predators. This is a unique. You talk about forage fish. It's going to be a unique deal that we've got to come up with, recreational and commercial.
And we think forage fish is critical.
Yeah.
So.
Thanks to everyone.
All right. New business?
One more question.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Mr. Bull doesn't want any more proxies, so what happens when we show up and don't have a forum? It's not Mr. Bull anymore.
We'll have to see how that goes. Now, what happened with the proxies is that we started taking account of attendance over a few years. And there was I don't have it exactly right probably, but when we looked at when there were quorums, FinFish only missed one quorum, but when we looked when there were quorums, it was because of proxies. Now the commissioner, when he appoints you to a committee, it's for a specific reason that happens. And then pretty soon, proxies were pretty evident to make up the quorum. And proxies were also just doing, quite frankly, I'm so-and-so's proxy tonight. I'm Harry's proxy. You know, coming to the meeting, just saying that. When it all started out with proxies, it was a very formal process where the chief
was called or notified, is this okay to do that? And in fact, Skip Feller had done that, you know, before this meeting. But the commissioner at this time is still on the no proxies. You had 8 tonight, I think, which, you know, compared to having 11, that's pretty good. I think, you know, Scott's proposal is good. We'll look at the attendance and see if we can find, you know, a few more members, because Jack Randolph left too on the recreational side. So that's the reasoning behind it, Bobby, and I think it's good to have the continuity of the members, and apparently the commissioner does
now,
too.
My real question is, we drive a long way to get here. So what's actually going to happen? We get here and we got 5 members here. Is that going to be a meeting? Are we all going home or what?
You're going to have a meeting. Your input to the commission is just as important without a quorum as it is with a quorum. We suffered through that with the CRAB committee. I think the last 5 CRAB meetings, we've only had 1 quorum. But nonetheless, people who participate, that information goes to the commission. Now, we're not going to report to the commission about tonight, tomorrow. But when we get to a point where we get past May, we will start having a report to the commission on what the FinFish committee is thinking about striped bass, for example. And then when we get to a public hearing, whenever the ASMSC or however things work out, it's very fluid. I don't have the answer on how things are going to go. You know, we will definitely give the information. And at that time, talk about driving a lot. I mean, other than John, I think Jeff comes a long way. You know, it's always good to have the chairman present the FinFish Management Advisory Committee recommendations as well. But staff's always been pretty faithful as far as promoting whatever you do. So.
Any new business from the audience? Seeing none, motion to adjourn. Second. Motion to adjourn. Committee. Can you do those online?
You can do them electronically, correct?
That's good.
All the way in.